The first thing, we do this twice a year, is required public meeting under Section 3.01J9 of Article 6243A1 of Vernon's Revised Civil Statutes. The regular and supplemental meetings are called to order, and both of those are recessed. And then we'll go to the required public meeting, starting off with anyone in the public like to say anything.
I'm Jay Donnell Willis. I'm on the Dallas City Council. I've been attending your meetings over the past year. Just a couple of things I've been out of country, so I really appreciate being able to come in person and hear what you all have to say and connect with citizens. I will say that if you were to be listening to this, a member of the public or your membership, it's not so easy. So I would ask the board to take a look at how easy it is to hear what's going on in these meetings. Sometimes the audio drops out, there's not video. So I just want you to be aware of that because I think that's really important that others can listen to what's going on. A couple of weeks ago, I went to Austin as the staff and board to hear the House Committee of Pensions. And some things that stood out to me that I thought would be important to convey are about the one thing that's brought up by a number of people. Was about government and the importance of guardrails. And I know that you all have some guardrails, some were defined by the legislature. But there are more. There's more that can be done. And in fact, this fund is a bit of an anomaly. And I think you have to go no further than the front page of the Dallas Morning News today to see how having guardrails is something that's really important with regard to a fund and a board of directors and how it's managed. So I would encourage you all to look at some of the recommendations that have been made, see how you might be able to strengthen those, just for the benefit of all, for your membership, city board, this fund, and your administration. Another thing that was brought up quite frequently by those who were testifying, I think actually around ESG practices with the state, but it really struck me in listening to this, was about the independent evaluations that they had done with their funds. So this is, again, with the overall objective that I think we all share, which is to have a sound plan, a well-performing plan for the benefit of your membership. So the City of Dallas undertook having an independent evaluation of our own. And this was a legally defined competitive procurement process. And so it's a little disappointing to have my character besmirched and the city's process besmirched. This is all legally defined and competitive. And so if there are any issues or concerns that anyone has, Mr. Chair, I would ask if you do that for the Inspector General or, you know, to find out or pursue whatever concerns they may have. But I'm standing before you to tell you that we followed a process that's legally defined. And so what I would also ask of you all is there's been some discussion around the outcome. And I'd like to not worry so much about the messenger, but about the message. And again, this is an objective that we share. That is to have a sound, well-performing plan. I think that is something that we could all agree on. And so I would ask, I think it was discussed at the last meeting, about having the independent evaluator, Commerce Street, come before you and get it on your agenda to test and discuss, as some say. And so I think it was suggested maybe they weren't willing to do that. And they're absolutely willing. And I think it's an important discussion to have because if the objective is to get to a really sound, well-performing plan, to all keep that insulated in this room, I don't think there's a way to hone and sharpen. And so I would ask that you all ask the board chair, your staff, to be willing to get that on the agenda so that you can go on and ask your own questions and hear what the audience is. One thing that I also hear commonly brought up every month is about employee retirement funds. It does pay a COLA because it is a funding level where they're able to do that. You know, the legislature defined with this fund not being able to pay a COLA until the fund purchase can be spent. So the City of Dallas understood that, and during our last budget process, we, even though financially it may not make sense, a gesture needed to be made, and we had to aside a stipend to try to make that payment to funds with the filing of the lawsuit have been set aside. So there they are. But they, I think that's still the intention. But with the uncertainty that that introduced, we decided that we just go forward with that financial commitment, but we are holding those funds. So I want everyone to believe that FIRE in this membership and this board to understand that that is the intention and that that is where our heads and our hearts are. So the members, retirees who come to our meetings and have come to the city working through this process of our budgeting and about the restoration plan have heard talk of this stipend. So they knew it was hanging out there before them. So I just want you to know that last month I heard points made around this lawsuit was always going to be fired, always going to have to be defined. And so to do it at that particular point feels a little bit cruel. And I just want you to all understand, if you didn't understand the timing or why we've been discussed, and that there was very much intention to make that kind of gesture, what impact has been. And when they let me know their concerns, I share with them how it all went down. Another thing that's brought up about the ERS is, well, that's not brought up, is the discount rate. You all have a difference. So theirs is 7.25% or 6.5%. And so over the course of 30 years, the difference this could make the city of Dallas, the city of Dallas taxpayers that funds this, is $450 million. So it's not chump change. That's a pretty big deal. So we've asked the question and have not really gotten a satisfactory answer on why this fund cannot challenge reform at a higher level to help close that gap. In the study done with restoration plan, if you look at the way the numbers are, it's pretty significant. I mean, it gets up to over $500 million that the Dallas taxpayers will be contributing unless the fund is performing better. And I think that that is something that you all would hope to do. And so I'm saying that we're at a point now that we can work on that and be collaborative on that and listen to some outside voices and challenge those and just consider how you might improve performance of this fund. So thank you for letting me attend all of these months. It's been interesting and educational. I just would say to the board, I've been a CEO, I've got a board of directors, and I understand what the dynamic can be. You all are busy people, and I know you study your minutes and you study your reports, but this is your full-time job. And so I would ask you to redouble your efforts to get to our shared goal and the shared outcome that we want. Challenge your staff, challenge our independent evaluator, and really come to the table with the intent that the city has, as well as the Fed Center, to get the best that we can for a membership. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilwoman. If there are any suggestions on how the AV side of it, we welcome those to make it more clear.
That would be a staff. Okay. So
you brought it up, so I'm just saying any suggestions you have would be helpful.
But yeah, I think audio drops out and there's not video, so I think as a retiree would watch, I guess Frank does have an ADA director now, so why don't I ask him to get in touch?
Okay.
Sure.
We have Super John over there, so he's done a great job. And I would also note that you have attended this, so, you know, speaking up, you know, versus someone who just shows up to say something, have noted your physical attendance in most meetings, and so, we know that you're dealing in good faith, as we are. As someone once said, the thinnest pancake has a few sides to it, so, you know, we can get perspectives on some of the things you mentioned. This isn't the time to go through all those, but we appreciate your comments. So, now we'll turn it over to Jeff and Caitlin at Siegel. We're already all experts on actuarial, so, you know,
this will be an easy meeting then.
Smart people on this issue.
All right, thank you. We do have the 2024 evaluation for you. We're going to go through a summary presentation, I believe. I assume that's. Let me see if I can. Excellent. We have the full valuation report as well. If there's any questions anyone seen in there addressing this, please let us know. Anything in the report you want to go over, we certainly can. We're going to jump into it. We'll touch briefly on the changes since the 2023 evaluation, obviously the changes the board adopted at the August 8th meeting, one of which was to reset the actuarial value of assets, the market value of assets retroactive to 1/1/2023. We restated our 23 results, not our liabilities, when we're going to do this. We had to go back and redo 2023 before we do 2024. So we reset the market value, recognized almost $247 million in losses immediately instead of smoothing out over a five-year period. So the actuarial value of assets was less than it would have been otherwise for 2020. It wasn't a 2023 report. So we restated those results. That was our starting point for 2024. We couldn't really do 24 without redoing the 23 first. We did some work there. There were two amortization bases established for 2023. The amounts were based on his other work, but we incorporated those for our 2023 starting point. There's a amortization base of $2.25 billion, amortized for 30 years. The amortization period was reset at 30 years, the level percent of pay. And then one of approximately $1.33 billion, and this base is this was the three-year step-up period, the three-year step-up phase, meaning the amortization payments are lower. You're paying for the actuarial determined contribution. The amortization payments in the first 3 years in this phase are lower than they would have otherwise. Then after that three-year period, the amortization payments, the remaining 27 years, are a little bit greater than they would have been otherwise. So just kind of a temporary step-up. This is not work that we did. This is we're incorporating other work that the board adopted. And in the actuarial return contribution in the past, there was not a projection on it. We calculated it as a valuation date, which is not typically how it's done, but with a statutory contribution rate, the ADEC was not being paid. And it not that it didn't matter, but there was no projection included because statutory rate was being paid. Now it's been determined that the contribution we paid in the city's fiscal year being 21 months after the valuation date. So the ADEC we're calculating in this 1/1/2024 valuation would be paid beginning in the city's fiscal year beginning October 1, 2025. So we're calculating that as 1/1/2024 and then we're projecting that out with the appropriate interest 21 months. And please jump in at any time. I know this is a lot of
Okay, jump in. I just wanted to say kind of two things based on what you've said so far. So first of all, this valuation is different than you've seen before. And it's different than a valuation would have been that you would have seen had we been able to do it, say, 4 months ago. Because, as you all know, we are always late in our valuation, which makes us late in our audit, which makes us on the CRB's late list that they notify the city of. But all of that revolves around the Huff late asset reporting and their material. Had we done this valuation timely and had all the information to be able to do that, say, and done it in May, it would have been based on the plan that was in the statute. But in August, the board adopted the new plan, so Jeff and Caitlin have to take the plan that is adopted and value that. That's why this looks a little bit strange. So this reflects the August 8th plan. It would have been totally different had we done it a few months earlier and didn't have that plan adopted. The other thing, and maybe you said this and I missed it, the resetting of the market actuarial value of assets to the market value of assets, that had us realize a loss immediately, which most systems are realizing that over the next 4 years. That was a request of the city as we went through this the process with Chiron. So that's why that decision was made. Just wanted to point those two things out as you move forward.
So what is the repercussions of that by taking those losses up front?
Well, I can let Jeff talk about it. I mean, our funding levels so low, it lowers the funding level, but we're low anyway. It makes us look worse than we would have, but we already look bad. So
it makes the ADEC higher than it would have been.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. The funding ratio, I think, without the reset of ABA, I think last year's was about 39%. I dropped it to about 34%. So it's just that, I think the numbers here, it's like $250 million in losses that were being smoothed out, not recognized
up front.
Yeah,
$250 million. Wow.
I mean, 22 is not a good year
for anybody.
And then all of a sudden, it's like, hey, we're going to recognize all these losses at the same time.
And the city wanted that those moved together because they were having, they didn't like the way that the increase from year to year wasn't, and the smoothing of those losses made it so it wasn't even. And for their budgeting purposes, the CFO preferred that, which is why it's.
So does that mean then the 23 gains are fully reflected or only partially reflected?
Partially.
Question.
The decision was made to recognize it all. Everything has a 1/1/23. So then you've got your actuarial value of assets. Just a reminder, the actuarial value of assets recognizes gains and losses over a 5-year period. So you recognize 20% of each year's gain and loss. You do it fairly, you do gain and loss. You're not gaming the system before. So that is a 1/1/23. So 2024 actuarial value of assets is recognizing 20% of the market gain for that occurred in 23.
And so, Brian, what was our 23 gain?
9.8%.
And then so
and the actuarial value
dollars. What is that dollars?
That's the percentage and. That's on a lag, so that looks different than the number that Jeff has because
yeah,
they true up.
As far as
but what's the dollar gain?
What we have, I said in the valuation, we had a 23 market value return of 13.9%, $129.4 million gain on a market value. And so it's back to the normal smoothing.
So you're just taking 20%. And then, like, 24 so far this year, we're up what?
We're up 9% on the total and 13.8 on the public portion.
Including out as well, right? It's only 20% of that.
Well, you have to keep in mind the way that the actuary calculates the way that the investment is slightly different, are two different numbers. They're generally not that far apart. This year, they're a little further apart, but those numbers aren't totally going to match us because they're used for different purposes.
You know, I mean, on the lagged investment basis, we had $215 million in gain and appreciation in 23.
So only roughly 20% of that. And then none of 24's gain, which is mid-100s, I think, or so.
Yeah, anything that's happened after 12/31/23 would not be reflected in the assets.
Okay. I think that's good kind of ground rule clarity for everybody to understand.
So 2024, we reflected the COLA. That's effective hopefully October 1, 2025, not to exceed 1.5%. The assumptions we use. We looked at this, we do projections, and this is based on when you hit certain market. You have the market value, you get a return, CPI.
I have a question on that. Because of the way that calculation is, it's very hard to predict because you're trying to predict the CPI of the future. You can kind of more or less predict our size, which are funding for the most part, and that would be a guesstimation, but doing the CPI would be. If you don't do that 1.5, and we never get to that 1.5, most instances, so how do you kind of smooth that number out to do those calculations?
Well, so that's a good question. The payroll growth assumption, inflation assumption we're using right now is 2.5%.
Okay.
So we're assuming that we're sticking with that, that that's going to be the inflation, is 2.5%. And we're projecting out when you're hitting, basically it's taking the market return percentage.
Funded percentage
times the CPI or the payroll growth assumptions, and then that's not to exceed 1.5%. Based on our projections, we simplified it a little bit. 0.85% for the first 5 years, 1% for the second 5 years, 1.25% for years 11 through 15, and then we assume hitting 1.5% at year 16.
Would you say that that would be on the higher end? In other words, it probably would be less expensive.
That's hard to say.
Yeah, it's hard to say because, you know, in actuality. What is inflation? Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
What's your returns going to be? I mean, everything assumes.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
What gets actually contributed?
Yeah, got it.
Yeah. Chiron's assumption was different than this, but not materially so. We valued it both ways. But this is the assumption we use. So it's art as much as science trying to predict what's going to happen for the next.
And would it like not be a normal distribution because of the cap? So if inflation is running really hot, you're going to cap out more often.
Well,
so
yeah, the highest will be is the 1.5%.
Yeah,
right.
Could assume that in the years to kind of get that way first and scale it back, and you know it increases liability, but.
Yeah, I mean, there's costs involved with COLAs, and it's not immaterial usually, but it's, I think they're important, but it's outside of our decision making. We just come up with the assumptions and the values. So the ADEC we determined for valuation payable, again, October 1, 2025, approximately $262 million. Or 53.47% of projected pay. About almost 39 million of the ADEC was due to the COLA. So you can see the cost associated with it there. And just a reminder, the actuarially determined contribution is the employer, the city's normal cost, which is the amount going toward the benefits accrued, plus the amortization of the unfunded liability, which is all gains, cumulative gains and losses, assumption changes, method changes, plan changes. Accumulated to date. So the city's portion they're paying toward the benefits alone is 8.5%. The members are paying 13.5%. The difference is what's payable toward the unfunded. The total gain loss of the year, actually, it was a small gain. 0.9%, gain for investments of 0.49%, and gain for demographic and other experience of 0.44%. That's a really small, we like small demographic gains or losses. I mean, we like them to be small. It shows that our assumptions are not far off what's actually going on. And the fact that the gain is even better. So the funding ratios on an actuarial basis dropped from 34.42% to 32.02%. And on a market basis, drop from 34.42 to 33.83. So, yeah, it is what it is.
I just put that, especially on the market basis. When you'll notice, like last year, the ratios are the same, and that's showing that reason, both at 34%. But then, you know, market basis, even though it was a good investment year, that drop is due to increase in liability, greater than the increase in the market value of assets there.
Right. If you have, so in the smoothing, if you have all gains in your smoothing period, your actuarial value of assets is going to be less than the market value of assets. And you had a gain in 2023, the year after we reset smoothing methods, so your actuarial value of assets is actually less right now than your market value of assets. Apologies. The actuarial value is $1.83 billion and the market value is $1.93 billion. And then your cash outflow increased by a little over $4.4 million, which is the benefit payments and administrative expenses were $114.8 million greater than the employer and employee contribution. So, I mean, this is not a situation you're where you're at funding percentage wise, you're not going to be able to invest your way out.
Say it again.
You're not going to be.
I just want to make it.
You're
clear.
Not going to be able to just invest your way out.
Thank you.
It's going to come down to contributions, and that's just you can hit your target from here until whatever. You've got to have more money coming in, and that's the only way to get to where you want to go. With and you did have a good market return year, which is the first time in a while. I know you've been unwinding the old assets, and it's taken a while. And then you hit your actuarial target for the first time in a while as well. So that's good. So there are some differences in the work we've done versus Chiron, and it's just different methodologies, different the way we go about it. We were asked to put something in here, kind of explain, hey, we've seen the numbers in Chiron, we've seen yours, yours is different, why is it? And that's, those are perfectly good questions. If I can speak, we'll get to that. You can take over for a second.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry.
Obviously, you know, Chiron put their analysis together, and that was the basis for what the board adopted back in August. And then, you know, we did our calculations, and they came in differently. So we just wanted to kind of explain, you know, why they were coming in different and what we were seeing. Looking at that table there at the right, it kind of breaks down the numbers. But, you know, the top line, liability-wise, we were pretty close. You know, two actuaries calculate the same number, and we're always different. We never match perfectly, but... You know, their projected 1/1/24 UAL came in about 0.4%. It was pretty close in line. Most notable difference in how we went about calculating the ADC and they did is they then adjusted the unfunded liability to account for the expected contributions to be made from the valuation date 1/1/24 through the beginning of the fiscal year 10/1/25. It's 21 months of expected contributions. So that's that $262 million you see there. They took that out of their unfunded liability. We're not following that methodology. You know, don't love the idea of banking contributions that haven't been made yet. This isn't money that you're showing as receivable as you're on your assets. This is kind of a expectation that these contributions will be made. So when we did our calculation, we didn't include that adjustment, which means when we went to then amortize the unfunded liability, obviously we were starting from a higher point, which resulted in a higher ADEC ultimately for the city. When you take that 30 years out, though, obviously if you're, you know, the bottom line there, that shows the cumulative 30-year projected ADCs from what we calculated for the next 30 years and what Chiron calculated, and they're actually pretty close ultimately. And Siegel's number is slightly less. So that's like $11.2 billion compared to $11.3 billion. Obviously, some of that is our numbers are higher early on, which means you're paying less interest down the line.
And we're not saying the right and wrong way here. We don't like the idea of including 12 months of receivables that you haven't included. So it's a different philosophy, different method. We're not asking aspersions. We're not saying we're right, they're wrong, and I think they'd say that we're wrong, they're right. I think it's just a different way of looking at it.
Chuck, let me ask you this. So just I think kind of our way of thinking about it is that you would have your starting point on which you're basing the ADC. You have here you have 1/1/24, but then you're not hitting the go button until 10/25. So I think our simplistic way we would just assume those would be the same dates. Like you're where you're starting from a liability standpoint, and then you start paying that down over time. If the date was instead of 1/1/24 was 10/1/25 UAL, would most likely you and Chiron have the exact same number based on what you know or not, or you can't answer that?
I'm not completely sure. I mean, Chiron, we're calculating things as of the same date.
Let me ask that, if the UAL date was not 1/1/24, 10/1/25, okay, and that's in the future, would your UAL be different, and would your ADAC, your ADC be different?
If we took a 10-1, you know, we did the valuation as of 10-1-20, you know.
I'm not quite sure. I mean, Chiron and I are.
I'm not asking what Chiron did. I'm asking you did that.
your measurement date of like how high the mountain was is 1/1/24, but you're not starting measuring kind of the trek down to fully funded until 10/1/25, right?
Correct.
Okay. If they were the same date, how would this be different?
Well, they wouldn't have 21 months of projected interest in the actual determined contribution.
But you don't have that in your. I'm not asking what Kyron did.
No, I'm asking the same. We're using the same dates. Like we both have the same UAL date. I mean, one difference is they're working from the 2023 valuation. Mm-hmm. They're projecting everything from 23 valuation, and we're starting at 1/1/24 because we have the most recent demographic information and assets, and they've been doing this. And right, they've been doing this for a while, so they didn't have the 2024 available when they were doing a lot of their work. So that's one difference is kind of a starting point.
So if they had the 24 number, their numbers would look closer to yours?
The liability numbers are really close already. I mean, they're at a unfunded liability of $3.9 billion. We're different by $16 million. I was really happy to see. And which I expected. I would expect them, when they did their initial replication of our 2023 valuation, the liabilities and normal costs were close. They're never going to be exactly the same, but they were close, and we were happy with that. They were, I would assume, and I'm happy that our 2024 starting point of the liabilities are similar. The difference is they're discounting 21 months of contributions that we hope are made between 1/1/24. I mean, we have contributions being made. The exact dollars, we don't know. But they're discounting contributions expected from January 24 through 9/30/2025. They're essentially treating that as an asset receivable as of 1/1/24. And then doing that, they're lowering the unfunded liability.
Contributions, defined contributions coming from
the city?
Coming from the city.
Right. Not from members, but from the city. Well, yeah. Right. Let's be clear.
They're discounting 21 months of expected city contributions applicable toward the unfunded liability over and above normal contributions. And they're using that as a 1/1/24 to lower the unfunded liability. So in doing that, where our unfunded liability was very, very similar previously, all of a sudden their unfunded is $262 million less than it was before they did that. So the amortization payment is less on their end, and that's the difference in the contribution. Nick, I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, if that answered your question.
I think I understand where you're coming from.
I'm just saying, if we would ideally, if your auditors and your staff and everybody said, hey, this is what we think is the way to do it, and the auditors want to include 21 months of receivable contributions expected in the audit and restate the 24 numbers. And while I still wouldn't like that approach, if your audit had that in there, we would use that.
Okay, well, let me ask the question the other way. If you just found out today that there's been no contribution to city or members since January of 2024, mm-hmm. and there's none expected until October of 2025, would your numbers be correct for your methodology?
Our numbers would, I don't say better, but our numbers would be appropriate because we are not.
But you wouldn't change one number of those four numbers you're public, if you have there, you wouldn't change any of those if you became aware of that.
Correct, because we're not counting on contributions
that
haven't been made yet.
Does that capture the point for everyone?
That's
their assumption. So we believe, we're told by staff, and we can look at accounts and see the contributions have been made,
of course,
so far this year. There's a full expectation that the city will continue to make the contributions through this date, and they're ignoring that fact.
Well, can I respond to that?
Yeah.
It makes it sound like we're oblivious to the fact contributions are being made. Of course contributions are being made. This is, our approach is pretty standard. I mean, that's the way it's done.
I'm not casting. I just want to understand. I'm just trying to make us understand something at the sophomore level that you guys are PhDs in. We have to grasp the things that we get. And so the clarity of saying that if no contributions have been made, this would be your analysis would still be your analysis. There'd be no adjustment to it. I think for everyone, that's a good crystallizing thought to understand the assumptions they did and how it carries through, and that common sense tells us and that contributions have been made and continue to be made. So we understand that when we do come to a great agreement with the city, which we fully expect will happen in due course, that we'll sit down, isolate all the assumptions to date certain, and there'll be clarity to it. But this is a good roadmap, but it's not the perfect roadmap. But it's what SQL stands behind, and we accept that.
Again, I just want to be clear. When you are talking about contributions that you are accounting for and not accounting for, qualify them, please.
The city contributions.
Okay. So it's not member contributions. It's just the city contributions. And it's just all of the city contributions, not what they've given us and in addition to. So he's saying it's
the member contributions really just go towards the normal cost each year. When we do the ADEC calculation, we are just looking at the city's normal cost. We subtract off the expected employer or member contribution.
Right. It's the total normal cost, and we add in the administrative expense assumption and then subtract out what the employees are expected to pay.
So, again, let me just reiterate. It is not the member contributions. It's just the city, and yours says zero. City contributed nothing until the 25th.
Yeah, we're not accounting for, we're saying this is the unfunded liability as of 1/1/24. You know, we're not taking into account any money that may come in after the fact.
Which is typically the way it's done. You typically don't have 21 months of contributions that haven't been made, lower your unfunded liability now, because there's a great risk in that, because you don't really know the amount of contributions are going to be made. You might know what's agreed to be made or what's said to be made, but until that money is actually paid, you don't know. And even if it was locked in a vault and you know, guaranteed that $262 million was going to be paid in 21 months, it's still not there as of the valuation date. It's not in your audit. It's not, I mean, your auditor wants to reissue the 24 audit with $262 million of receivable contributions. Like I said, I still wouldn't like that method, but I would use the audited assets provided. But
I think this has brought clarity. I think we understand your starting point and your applying professional standards to it. And we, just because we don't know as much about actuarial analysis as you guys do, have to make sense of it. Does everyone feel like they made sense of it?
So I had extensive conversations with both Siegel and Chiron on this. And what I took away from those conversations is both are reasonable approaches. Both reasonable actuaries can do it this way or this way. And there's arguments really on both sides. And so that's kind of where we are. Siegel's our actuary, and they've recommended this approach.
Okay. Like I said, over the course of the projected 30-year period, I mean, our contributions are less because, like Caitlin said, our contributions are higher up front, so you're paying less interest down the road.
So we're starting with basically the same UAL, or unfunded liability. Over 30 years, the contributions are basically the same. They're $100 million less under Siegel's method than Chiron. It's just the pattern.
Right.
That's the difference in the two methods.
All right. I think everything else is just, you know, filler after that. So this is a summary page, and this page is in the report as well. It's a comparison of the prior year to this year. One thing to note, I guess, top right corner, we removed. Typically, there would have been the prior year ADEC, like from our 2023 evaluation. But since that was done as a different time period and it was without the projection 21, we just thought it'd be too much apples to have it in there, so we just removed that number. Next year, you'll have that number be filled in with the 262 in the right column, your new number will be on the left. The liability in total. Liability in total, the first kind of on the about middle of the page, went up about not about $470 million. And a good chunk of that, how much is that? About $417 million of that was due to the COLA. Now, one thing I guess we should point out, it was mentioned on the prior page, but we didn't, We didn't really go into it. But, Chiron, in their work, included the COLA and the 2023 work. We did not. The 2023 valuation, COLA is effective October 1/25, and October 1/25, the 2024 is used for that calculation or for that contribution. But it doesn't, in the end, your the $262 million would be the same because the way the amortization bases were established, the way that amortization periods are dropping down each year, the 23 results will be different, but the 24 contribution will be the same. You've got to have a base to balance out the difference between the unfunded liability and your amortization basis. And I don't want to get too much into the actuarial talk, but the point is the fact that they did it 23 and we did it 24, a $262 million number would be the same. So that was the point of that. Like I said, we discussed a little bit already about the assets. And, we are projecting full funding right now of 2053. Chiron is projecting 2055. Isn't that right? 2055. The difference being really is the contribution pattern. But so much can happen between now and that point, regardless. I mean, both our assumptions, their assumptions, they're all assuming no future gains and losses. We know gains and losses. We just don't know which way they're going to go. But there's going to be gains and losses. You'll have, over the course of the period, you'll have that time frame out. Theoretically, the way the amortization for the closed period, theoretically, be fully funded. Again, that's the theory. The reality is it's a moving target. You can see the history of employer contributions over the past 8 years. This is why a lot of actuaries don't like statutory contribution rates, because they don't pay what really needs to be paid. We can't revisit history, or we can't redo history, but the contributions, if those contributions, both those columns were the same, you'd be in a little bit, be in better shape. But hopefully, ongoing. That's the goal. And you schedule a function of progress. There's been a lot happened in that 10-year period. A lot of assets were written off. Something changed. A lot of payments. If you recall, there was a big spike in payments dropped. Excuse me, when changes were occurring. And from here on out, the rest of the presentation is some of the summary information in the report. You can see we are projecting 2053 full funding. The ADEC, the dollar amount, it gets up there. I mean, when your amortization period gets lower and lower and lower, your amortization fund over shorter periods of the dollar goes up. But, Chiron got a similar pattern. I think their differences year to year are larger than ours. That's just because ours are greater up front than theirs. So theirs build up more. Somewhere.
Yeah, some of the step up, that is that 3-year step up period where that one base is kind of your payment on the unfunded for that one grade of stepping up. And that's kind of the year why it goes up dramatically in the first year. And it kind of, it's still increasing, but less dramatically.
Exactly. You can do this for 3 years. And from here on, we have some business information and some asset history. I don't know how much you want to get into the backing, supporting information. I mean, I think the biggest takeaway on our end is we were trying to, you know, reconcile the differences between ours and Chiron's numbers, and we thought maybe it had something to do with COLA when the COLA was first put in, and their assumption. We ran their assumption also, and our assumption, and what it boiled down to is, you know, our liabilities were so close. That's all the difference there is. If they weren't doing that or we were doing that, our index numbers would be very similar. I'm not going to skip that. You can see the asset smoothing. You can see the lines are fairly similar for most years, which shows that the asset smoothing is working. You don't want big ups and downs in your asset value each year. You want to try to be a little more predictable, and your smoothing period has been working. It was reset in 2015 prior to, or and then it was reset this year, or in 2023. But
those first 2 years, those are write downs in the assets that you guys had to recognize.
Okay. Yeah, there was like a $500 million asset written down, which kind of precipitated the drop in the fund. So there was a couple things really. The discount rate prior to Siegel in 2014 was 8.5%, and then in 2015 that dropped to 7.25%, and then we came on in 2016. So you're 25 basis points a year. That's a big impact on your money. And follow that up a few years later with writing down $500 million, and that's another hit. So those are the two things that really spurred it on.
And the drop payouts during 2016, I think it was $800 million.
$825 million. In the past, it'd been like $250 million, $270 million. So it was just a perfect stuff that went against you, unfortunately. But so. I've gone through most of the presentation, and we've hit the important parts, the highlights. Is there anything else in the evaluation report that if you've had a chance to look at, John, or any questions? That was a lot we've thrown at you. Y'all been inundated with stuff over the past year between the independent analysis and there's a lot of iterations of things, a lot of stuff y'all seen. I'm sure. Just on our end, looking at all the stuff, some of the stuff y'all seen, I'm like, man, there's a lot there, which needs to be. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of work done. It's just a lot to keep up with. So, if any questions, please let us know.
Jeff, will you address the assumed rate of return 6.5 versus 7.25? Because the 7.25 has been our 6.5% has been portrayed that we're not shooting to get to a higher number, when really that isn't the case. We're always trying to shoot to get to
the
best number we can. But is it a negative that we're using 6.5% versus 7.25%? And what would you think if we came to you today and said we're going to raise that to 7.25%?
Please don't. The 7.25, just for what it's worth, NASRA, the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, they do a great survey every year, public sector universe. I think it's NASRA.org, I believe, is their website. One of the things I look at every year is part of their survey is the return assumption. That's the biggest driver. That's the most press for a lot of times. The assumption is, what is your return assumption? They look at, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, it's the bulk of the public sector universe. The plans they look at incorporate the bulk of the members of the public sector universe, not every single plan, obviously, but their average and their medians are both just under 7%. So
their average and their median are just under 7%.
They're right there, the high 6.9, I don't think anything's above 7 now. I know it's not. And you don't have to tell plans. You don't have to be leading the pack. You don't have to, you know, just because your friends jumped off the bridge, you don't have to. But 7.25 is a little, I guess, behind the low tech universe as a whole. But really, 6.5, I mean, not to belabor the fact, but this is your last 16 year of return history right here. And I know you're still unwinding from a bunch of prior investments that predate this board. And you can't just look at the past. You got to look at the capital market assumptions as well. I think 7.25 is higher than this plan should be. There's nothing magical about 6.5. I like it, but I think 7.25 is too high. But there's a range you can look at that's reasonable.
But isn't the presumption that 6.5 really reflects the health of the fund as it is today, and putting anything higher is making the presumption?
If you had a sustained history of hitting a higher target, that's one thing. I mean, it's a combination of what have you done in the past and what's expected in the future with the capital market assumptions. And there's a lot of investment professionals here, more so than myself, so I don't want to speak to that. But we look at capital market assumptions. Siegel and Marco Advisors are the investment arm of Siegel. We look at what they provide. Verizon does a more cumulative together assumption as well. And from what we're seeing, I mean, I think 7.25 is a stretch right now.
You made an earlier comment about we need money for investing to get out of this. Investing is not going to get us out of this. How would you use that statement with that when you look at the assumptions and where we are?
Just part of that is looking at your cash flows. I think they, for last year, it was about like 6.25% cash burn. You know, so what's the gap there? Investing-wise, pulling double digits every year is just not reasonable. And that's really what it would take to get you to a point without, you know, having an increase on the contribution side of things.
Yeah, so we have a burn rate actually in 23 is 5.7% of the average market value of assets. And that's a little bit higher than a lot of plans. And I have some that are higher than that, but they're also not in good shape for the most part. When your cash outflows are 6.5% of your average market value, just hitting 6.5% return each year is not going to get you there. You've got to. So that doesn't matter what your assumption is. Your assumption could be 8%, and the fact is the cash flows are what they are. If you had your assumption is too high, then all that does is you're understating your liability. I'm not saying anything about this. I don't work on the city's plan. I'm not familiar with the specifics. I'll say that 7.25 is higher than the bulk of the, or it's higher than the average and the median of the public sector universe. Maybe it's appropriate for their fund. I don't know. I don't specific to their fund. Based on this fund and what I've seen, I would not think it's appropriate for this fund, though.
So the higher you have, a higher return, 7.25 is going to show that your plan's better funded than if you have.
If your percentage was 7.25, yes, your liabilities and normal costs would be less, and your percentage would be higher. But does that mean? I mean, ultimately, the cost of the plan are the benefits paid and the expenses paid. I mean, that's the ultimate cost. Is what are your benefits? What are your expenses? Everything else is just.
The fact of the matter is, you know, it's a very good chart here. The fact of the matter is, what happened in 2014 when we had that huge shift, and those are assets that we could have done fire sales, or we could have tried to do strategic and try to get the best price that we could, which is, I think, looking back, was probably the right deal. But if we were to try to, once we had that huge dip in 2014, trying to recover from that, you could either be what's the right word? If you chase returns, trying to get out of the hole, chasing returns or trying to get the highest return, which is different from a place that was in a much more healthy situation. The other side of that is you could get the entity card. You're taking higher risk.
Right.
So you might get lucky and make more a better return, but you also the other side of that you could have some more dips.
Right. Well, I guess I'd say Las Vegas wasn't built on winners.
I'm actually glad you brought that up because I equate it to that. You've lost, and then for gamblers, they think, oh, well, I just have to keep betting more higher so that if I win greater. And that's how we got into this mess. And again, this is prior to most of the people in this room. So fixing it, surely we're not going to adopt the same strategy that got us there. I want to say something about the actuarial, the assumption for return. It really comes down to mathematics. When investors are looking to invest in bonds or in equities, they often look to the third party scrutinization by maybe the rating agencies. They're supposed to be, a third-party independent voice of what the numbers actually mean. With those entities, the analysis that takes place of those financials pertaining to the particular investment, if there is a pension liability there, and the number, the expected return on that pension's return is too high, that actually is something that is flagged to investors. Like, this is an overstated number. There's no way, this is unrealistic for this particular entity to assume that because they've had growth at a certain rate, that's going to continue because market dynamics are changing. So, After the crisis in 2008, many of the pension funds, many of companies who had pension plans, they had to adjust that return because there's no way that 7 or 8, and was it 8.5 at some point in some plans, 8.5, 9%. It's ludicrous to think that after the economic meltdown that they were continue to make that or even assume that they could even reach that. That would require very risky investments. So that return number, I think, is, I don't think it's just a function of it being appropriate for this plan. It has everything to do, mostly to do, with market dynamics. And whether or not a board or a CFO or a CIO thinks that they can outperform the market is, there's an inherent risk there. And so I think that the devil is in the details. And unless you are constantly in that space where you understand at the granular level what it means to move that number, I don't necessarily think it's a holistic view of the repercussions of what that can have on a plan.
So you're right, Nancy. So when we set the 6.5%, we had a range to choose from, and the board chose 6.5%. And what you all looked at the time was the probability based on the capital market assumptions from on making that. And the higher levels were a 50-50 shot. And given the history of our plan, we knew that we needed to get it fully funded, and we wanted to not present a more rosy picture than it actually was to the city, we decided to go with a lower rate that we had a higher probability of making. Even then, the probability, I don't believe, was over 60%. But it, you know, it's not a guarantee, but we wanted to make sure it was realistic.
Okay. When do we do that? When did we take it down?
The last experience study was 2020.
Lowered it then, and then we came back the next year and you lowered it further, and you know, obviously at that point.
And then we got 22, and that also, you know, so then that reflects the capital market.
Yeah, I'm looking at this assumption, right? This is crazy that 8.5 would not have been changed after the economic downturn. I mean, it's just crazy.
I just want to reiterate, we were not the actuary at that.
I understand that, but this is just irresponsible and crazy. That there's no way that in 2008 any plan was making 8.5% return. No plan. Ask CalPERS and CalSTRS. Everybody. There's no way that this assumption. So maybe the shock that it was so high, and then there was slight adjustment, and then an adjustment. Maybe it's the context, I think, here is very misleading, given the fact that there was no movement on the assumed rate. I can't even believe it. It's so crazy that this would not have moved after the 2008. I don't know who the actuary was at that time, but it's just irresponsible.
I'd like to just make an analogy. It might be a good analogy for the public to know. What happened in 2008 is basically someone who got in a very, very car accident where they basically were in a coma, broken legs, everything possibly happened to it, almost, you know, basically flatlining. And new board, new procedures came in, but we were still having to deal with someone who was critically, critically injured. For the last, you know, I would say over 4 or 5 years, you've been basically doing some serious physical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You want them to run. You want them to get back to where they need to be. But you can't basically assume that they're going to be the same as someone who hadn't got into a very, very serious, life-threatening accident. Now, that doesn't mean that there are not tweaks that could have gone one way or the other. But as a board member, since I believe it was 2019, the analysis that's been put forth, relying on professionals. I've seen a lot of boards, and I think we've done the best that we could with the information that's available. And at the end of the day, if you wanted better returns, you also would have to deal with the possibility of having greater losses, trying to get rid of those assets.
And again, I just want to, going forward, as we heal and get better, that's not to say that we would reevaluate that with more money, with better performance down the line. But currently, as it is appropriate that we have 6.5, and it's not something we can invest out of, like invest to get higher. That's all I want to reiterate right now. And again, it's like you're just saying the national average right now is below 7. So anything, and we're not the national average. How about that? We're far below that.
And, you know, your liquidity.
Our liquidity needs, yeah.
A fund that's better funded.
Yeah, just a couple comments to add to what's already been said. And having set return assumptions in the past over a number of different relationships and different funds, bottom line, it comes down to the risk tolerance of the board and the trust that's involved. So you're looking at inflation assumptions, you're looking at asset allocation, you're looking at risk tolerance, and you're looking at market dynamics at the point in time. So where we are right now, I think it's appropriate. As we get a better funding, we have continue to consolidate the current portfolio, and going forward, there will be a time based on good governance where we can reevaluate our return assumption. But we're not there yet. It's better to be conservative and prudent at this point in time than to say, well, oh, let's go over 7.5 or 8%. Overall, a lot of the funds in the U.S. have been bringing their actuarial assumptions down, the return assumptions down. And that's one, inflation, and two, because of a lot of the changing dynamics of the market. So that's what I speak for the rest.
I also would point out that in the last month, I think we had Deloitte, mm-hmm. who we have serious issues that they need to come back to us and answer about their independence and some of their reliance that is an incredibly incomplete and I would say disturbing, but notwithstanding, they did say that our 6.5% was reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, they chose to highlight it and said we should continue to revisit it, which, you know, is an example of revisiting it and hearing Jeff's comments, but we did hear that. And then also, you know, I did pay a ton of attention to Commerce Street's report, and on page 20, until on page 40, they said that DPFP has performed adequately in its public equity and fixed income, but has lagged in its private market investment. And it also says we perform competitively in its public equity portfolio compared to Texas peers, and that's 1, 3, 5, and 10-year data. So that's what Commerce Street said, so we did listen. And Deloitte said we also listened, even though we were very disturbed by several things they couldn't answer, that our 6.5% is reasonable. Anything else on this subject?
Just two things. I would encourage you to read the report, the valuation report. I mean, some people might not think it's a page turner, but you'll learn a lot about the plan if you read it. One little factoid that I've found interesting is in 2023, the city hired 367 police and fire. But by the end of the year, they only added 46. So that's the churn rate there.
Say that again.
So they hired between rehires and new people, they added 367 people. But by the end of the year, they only had 46 of those remaining, and they were all fire. The number of police officers has actually gone down for each of the last 5 years, or more, actually.
And what's the impact? Can you kind of, what does that mean for us, for the fund?
Well, what it means for the fund is it's just a continued issue on the contributions not being, salaries aren't going up to keep the contributions up. I mean, the city is trying. You can see that by, I mean, they're bringing them in, but they either, you know, they're retiring, as they have the right to do, or they're leaving. It's a challenge for the city. It's a challenge for all cities. It's not a Dallas city.
Right. Some of them don't make it past the year.
So I'd encourage you to read this. The last thing is, normally Jeff and Caitlin would present a little page on the supplemental plan. As you know, that's a minor compared to this plan. That report isn't quite ready, but you will see it next month. At the same time, we'll ask you to approve that plan next month at the same time you approve the audit. So it won't delay the completion of the audit.
Yeah, you'll have that report.
Okay.
We appreciate Siegel, Jeff. We appreciate what you do. Thanks for
thank you
and answering.
No.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. We're going to go ahead and adjourn this required public meeting, and then go back into the regular meeting. First, we're going to start off as we always do with a moment of silence.
We need a motion to adjourn.
Okay. Motion to adjourn the public meeting. Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. I need to do adjournment training. So we'd like to start off with a moment of silence for those members and pensioners who recently passed away, and then also General Bob's other people in Florida, and with just tragedy that we'll be learning about today, and appreciation for what first responders and others are doing down there to help out.
Amen.
Thank you. Now we have the meeting minutes from September 12th. Any comments or questions on any of those? I have a motion to approve those minutes. Second, all in favor say aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. Once again, another opportunity for public comment. Anyone like to say anything? John, anyone online?
Go press 5-star.
Okay, we'll move to item C1. We just had the presentation of the valuation, so. And we have a motion to approve the issuance of the January 1st, 2024 actuarial valuation report, subject to final review by BDO, our auditors, and review and approval by the executive director. The motion? Is that a goodbye or a motion?
No, I was just saying goodbye.
Can we have a motion?
I'm making a motion.
Okay. Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Kelly, 2.025. I think we've seen this before.
We have.
Yeah, okay. So let's get an update on that.
It's a regular one. Can you go to 210 for me? I have a short presentation. I'm just going to give you an update on what's happened since the last board meeting. It's 210 PDF. Not a lot, actually, has happened since the last board meeting. There was, as has been mentioned earlier in the meeting, a meeting down at the House of Representatives Committee on Pensions, Investments, and Financial Services Committee. We were asked to go speak at that, which we did. Josh and I were there to speak. Tina came to the meeting as well. The PRB spoke and the city spoke, and we each talked about that. The plan, PRB provided a little more information about the funding of our plan and some statistics, but there were some good questions, and that was just a procedural process that they go through. We'll definitely, if we have a bill in the session, we'll be in front of that committee again. We've not had any further conversations with the City of Dallas. I have been wondering if what the city's contributions are going to be based on now that their new fiscal year started. And David Fee, who's the actuary for the PRB, stated in their board meeting on September 25th that the city intends to make their employer contributions based on the city's plan that they adopted. It's actually they're making contributions based on calendar year numbers, not fiscal year numbers, even though they're paying it on a fiscal year. That's a reality. So that's, I guess, what we're expecting to see. They're not going to make contributions based on the plan that the board adopted at this time. On September 30th, the city provided what they're calling their funding sounding restoration plan to the PRB, and I provided some documents that they included in that just so you can see the tone of that submittal. And Josh will give you an update on the litigation when we go to the legal item. So
Kelly, on sort of an annualized basis, prior to this fiscal year, is what the city think they're going to do? What's the dollar difference?
On an annualized basis, if they do between what the city's plan as they adopted work versus what they budgeted?
No, versus what they were paying before that. What would be the annualized amount?
So it goes from what they have in their budget is $201 million and $184.
Okay.
So that's the difference. The 201 is actually an error. They should have more like a 215 number, but that'll be something they figure out. That's just under their plan. Going forward, I wanted to give you a calendar here. There's a hearing on the litigation down in Austin on October 30th. On November 14th, we have another board meeting where you will get the audit, draft of the audit, and draft of the supplemental valuation for your consideration for approval. There's a pension review board meeting on December 4th. Right now we're not on the agenda, but I wouldn't be surprised if either we don't ask to be on the agenda or the PRB doesn't ask us to be on there. So my assumption is we may be down there on December 4th. There's a board meeting on December 12th. And then the legislative session starts January 14th. The last day to introduce any bills is March 14th. If we have to have a bill, we would definitely want it introduced way before March 14th, but that's just the last day, and then the session ends June 2nd. So the dates to look forward coming up. Are there any questions about where we are or anything related to the plan?
If we say if we have to have a bill specific to us, the bill would be in the context of our of what?
So if we're trying to change what's in the statute and we feel like we need to do that through a legislative action versus the authority that we believe we have under 2.025 now that doesn't require legislative action, then we would want to run a bill. Or if the city or somebody else runs any sort of legislation that impacts the pension, whether it's funding or
every session there's usually a bill out there that we're trying to battle against. So that's just the general filing date. All I have on that item.
Okay. All right, the professional services committee meeting. You were going to speak to that.
I am. So we met with Siegel this morning and solicited feedback, great feedback about the staff responsiveness. Especially they highlighted that Kelly and Kelly's understanding of the plans and the different parts of the plan and just that understanding. And they're just a pleasure to work with all of you. So, really positive feedback.
Yes. Anything else?
You know, Rick Keyes has great things to say about staff.
All right. Okay. Ryan, portfolio update.
All right. John, can you go to 259? McKee, you guys can come up here. All right, so we got a lot on the investment agenda today, most importantly the asset allocation study. We did a preview of that last month. We'll be going through their full asset allocation review that we've been discussing with the IIC for the last 6 months. I'm sure we can spend more time talking about this and rate as it relates to their capital market assumptions there. Okay, so for the portfolio update, at the end of September, in Q3, we were up 9.2% for the overall portfolio. And up 13.8 for the public portion at cash, which makes up about 3/4 of the overall portfolio. On private markets, we got $60 million of distributions received year to date. Mentioned the sale in the Lone Star portfolio in early September that drove a big portion of that. We're working weekly on the custodian transition with a conversion planned at the beginning of the year from JP Morgan to BNY. And then with the sale coming out of the Lone Star portfolio and a few other private market distributions, we were able to rebalance proceeds into the public portion portfolio this week. Kyle will go over more details on that later on in the portfolio update. Looking forward at initiatives, a lot of it's kind of driven by the updated asset allocation. Once we get through board approval on that, we'll be working on investment policy statement revisions and updates to incorporate the new asset allocation, to incorporate the new private market provisions that we need as we embark on making new investments on the private market side. As it relates to the Commerce Street report, we talked about it a little bit last month after their meetings with the ad hoc committee and city council in August. There weren't available dates for them to come in September or October. So, and as a reminder, when that report, we agreed to work with Commerce Street, the board requested that they would have an opportunity to have them come in and provide the report to the board. So they're available to come in November. The two options are to have them in and do the discussion or proceed without doing that. So we wanted to get board reaction to what path we want to go forward on Commerce Street.
We did provide the transcripts from the meeting. Did you mention that, Ryan?
No, ahead of the September, we provided transcripts and kind of the video links to all three of the meetings that occurred.
I read the transcripts, so I was not impressed.
Nick, we're talking about kind of Commerce Street and what to do there with having them in November or not.
Did you like this? I don't understand what would come out of it.
I think that's the issue we've been wrestling with. But
I think in good faith we've been working with them and they still come out with what they want to. I can say to everybody what that discussion will be about, which is essentially the first and foremost is that they continue to compare us to other Texas pension plans when we are an anomaly. That's the first. The second is that we could be doing a good job, but he needs more time and money to reevaluate that. That's the second. And the third, we can solve all of these
problems and increase our assumption rate by more private equity. That's it in a nutshell. I will not want to meet with them.
I think I thought about this previously, and we, the police officer, we have a police oversight board who basically we've come to an agreement with them that they wanted to have some oversight, for lack of a better term, over officers and the critical incidents we had. And when they formed this board, when they recently when they met and we had a discussion with them, we said, well, you're going to do X, Y, and Z training to kind of understand what we do in our job, because obviously they're not, there's no police officers on the board. And none of the people did the training, and fortunately we don't really have to deal with them too much, but this is very comparable to that. To me, it's someone who does not have the expertise or the training of the people on this board. And I think it's just a waste of time to meet with someone who is really not qualified to be in a position to judge the actions of the people on this board who spent decades in this sector. I think it would just be a waste of time and distract us from our charter of resolving this, resolving this issue and moving forward with the pension and making it more healthy. I just think it would be a distraction, a waste of time.
What's the purpose of hiring this entity to interpret or to, I guess, interpret?
You're hired to do a review of practices.
Right, but interpret what we're doing?
So I was part of some discussions where I heard city council people speak about this. I'll summarize what I think I heard, which is that they wanted an independent view, or one that was, I guess, just working for the city to give a fresh look at our results and to give their qualified opinion. And we can talk about whether it's competent or not and that sort of thing. But I think that was the general view. My pushback at the time was that the governance that exists, where the mayor gets to appoint the majority board, should have satisfied that. And that what I've heard from the city council people is they didn't think that is sufficient enough. And that's why they wanted to do this. And because, there are people that an institution we hold in high respect, we've cooperated in that respect. I think there is a case to kind of letting him come in just so it takes one issue of noise and conflict off the table let Dory and Commerce Street come in and talk for 20 minutes and hear what he has to say. And I don't disagree with anyone's specific comment, but, I just think that part of our job is to work to take chaos, to reduce chaos and to reduce noise. And I just view, us not meeting with them just being something then the city can say, well, you're this, that, or the other. I read the report. I've quoted it several times because there's a couple of things in there that I think are worth noting. I respect someone who doesn't want to meet them, but my mild bias would be to go ahead and let them come in and talk for a few minutes.
I would concur. I think there needs to be, I'll call it rules of engagement, that are set beforehand so it doesn't get into he said, she said, and so forth. There needs to be certain rules as to if we ask the question, and rather than give a political answer, defer to getting an answer at the bottom, at the end of the day, kind of thing. But no, I don't have a problem, and I think it's important to want to show that we are willing to cooperate in any way and listen to ideas that how we can improve the process as we go forward. Concerns that city council has.
Same here. I concur. Doesn't hurt, but I do think there needs to be some rules of engagement.
If we put rules in place, what's to enforce that?
There aren't any.
It's just you put them in place.
Yeah, that's my point. I mean, I just don't. I don't understand the.
What's the objective?
The logic of. I understand that we want to be transparent and want to be able, which I think we are. These are public meetings. I just, if someone's not qualified to.
I would say that their objective is that the city, who's a legitimate party here in every respect, has made a legitimate request. And it's within the range of reasonableness of the request. And so I would want to accommodate that request. Unless it causes some huge undue hardship or detrimental effect on us, and that so it really is.
If we come here, if he comes here, and I mean the things I read, and I mean like these aren't things I'm coming up with. I'm not saying he's not qualified because it's just a broad statement. If you read the transcript and the things he perpetuates, it is quite clear as gold from the words he says that he's not qualified. If you all want to do it because you just want to show goodwill to the council and their choices for their advocacy, then fine. But it is going to be no, it's going to actually be worse than when Deloitte came because at least they were qualified.
So yeah, the other part of that I would say, though, the other side of that is light is usually better than darkness, and in that way, after the matter.
And the darkness he's perpetuated of firing here and there. I mean, like, come on.
You know, the other part of that is that we are able to respond right. And ask questions.
I think that's the difference is he's delivered a report that the city has accepted without really the benefit of the trustees to really challenge his assumptions and really kind of drill down. And for me personally, because I've avoided having any direct contact with them, I would love to have the opportunity for the trustees to really kind of on the record respond to the report that we haven't had a chance to respond, but we've had to suffer the consequences of his dispersion and his public.
And Michael, you give the most compelling reason why that I may change my mind and have him come here because we can actually in this appropriate forum show the level of disqualification he has. With that, I'm in.
So the reason, just to remind you why we, because having him come here was actually our idea, not the city's. And we did that as a condition to continue to work with him. But the reason we did that is because the first report that came out was so bad that we thought, well, if he commits to come talk to real investment professionals that are going to ask tough, hard questions, maybe we'll get a better report. And the report was better. Not great, but still better than the first report.
And how much involvement were you in that report that was of improvement?
We had a few meetings and
three meetings.
Provided a lot of information. A lot of it was ignored, but, you know, we provided. But the fact is the city seemed to be in their meetings interested in hiring somebody, whether it's this firm or a different firm, to do this ongoing. So I think hearing from you all, if this person ends up being the ongoing vendor, it would be helpful.
Can you guys hear me okay? This is Tony.
I see.
Go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, we're not going to hear the same stuff from him in person. He's going to be happy-go-lucky and we're doing a great job and, you know, we're going to get a totally different side of him. I mean, he's not going to engage in the stuff that he was saying with us because he knows it's a bunch of bull. We're going to get a different person if he comes in here.
I mean, I would say to that, Tony, I think we can recirculate the transcripts and what was said at the October or the August meeting so we don't have to respond to what, you know, he says at the meeting. We can ask him about those comments as well.
I mean, again, I think the issues will be still the same, you know, just comparing us with other pensions, more private equity, and, you know, what else?
I just feel like the damage that he's caused by the report and the acceptance by the city council members that his review is accurate in all ways has been very detrimental in the last couple of months, and I certainly would like to have the opportunity to explore that report directly with him.
And I think it's not unreasonable. I read some of it. I don't. The report to me is or his statements are not supportable, many of them, but in terms of engagement with the city, in that situation, I don't think it's an unreasonable request. And quite honestly, I think the education would be good.
For him?
So we can say sort of the will of the board right now is that we go ahead and invite
him. Yeah, sure.
You all want Tina to personally invite him?
Yes.
It will not be Tina. It will not be Tina.
No, I think Michael. Michael, that's you.
Listen, I understand why you're
I just feel like it's legitimizing him further. It's like the emperor has no clothes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That if we just go up and say he has no clothes, but everybody's like, oh, these clothes, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. It's like, it's just perpetuating someone that doesn't know
the way you have a kid in high school, the way that they ask each other the homecoming with those posters
or whatever.
Maybe you could do something like that.
A proposal.
With Commerce Street and just, you know.
Yeah, I mean.
I don't have an issue with him per se. I have an issue of what he's done and how I feel like it's more political than actual factual. This is my issue, is that when we worked so hard and he's come out and said we've done a crappy job and we have just really rolled up our sleeves, every single one of us, to do things so beyond our role as a trustee to help this fund and to come and say the things he says, it was just beyond insulting. And so,
there's gambling going on in that casino?
It's just beyond.
So anyway. And then also, maybe as a suggestion, we invite IAC members to come in and sit in on that. Do y'all think that'd be a good idea?
Yeah,
too?
I mean, I don't know that it is clear to the public or even the city the caliber of people who are now on this board and in the investment advisory committee.
Oh, invite, please invite.
I mean, anyone who is going to throw out numbers or assumptions better have done their homework, because there's a lot of expertise in this room. And then when you add the investment advisory, it's like the dream team versus, you know, I don't know. I don't understand how a report can be, if there was engagement with the staff and the information was there, then I don't understand how then it just went so, I don't understand.
I think it was intentional.
I don't understand. Okay,
we'll invite Tina, we'll do the poster and go by and invite Commerce Street.
All right, well, back to the portfolio.
So we do it for the next month, or
according to the last time I talked to Dory, he had availability at the October or the November meeting. So we'll confirm that
and make sure the IC gets,
and we'll notify the IC, and we'll kind of recirculate materials. What?
Yeah, number of days.
Yeah. Okay.
And yes, and please recirculate that last transcript, because that's just incredible reading.
Okay.
All right. Great. Well, thank you all. Good morning. So before we jump into kind of our portfolio performance, just a couple pieces of things we're watching in the market. Last month, the Fed cut its key policy rate by 0.5% in September, ending a pretty historic tightening of monetary policy. One kind of key thing that came out of that is they really emphasized their dependence on the data moving forward. Nothing was set in stone for the rest of the year. I found these two charts from the J.P. Morgan Guide to the Markets to be fairly insightful around kind of what's happened in the past following the first cut in a rate cutting cycle. And you can see there's a pretty wide dispersion across the board. So the first cut is one thing, but kind of the path they take and the way that the market reacts in the economy is really something we're going to be watching. Along the same lines, this is the Treasury yield curve looking back. You have the 10-year trough at the bottom there, the 10-year peak at the top. So you can kind of see that pretty meteoric rise that took place in just about 3 years. And we've kind of started to come down from that. And I think, importantly, the yield curve has become less inverted and starting to look a little bit more normal. Yields remain attractive compared to their historical levels, but one thing to note is that spreads are pretty tight, and so that's something to watch moving forward. Here's our equity market return chart that we have been kind of tracking since the 2022 drawdown. One thing to note, you kind of see at the bottom there, EM has lagged for some time. There's a pretty sharp increase in EM there that was driven by some stimulus news out of China. So the role that EM is going to play moving forward is going to be interesting to watch as well. Looking at our portfolio, our public market return year to date is 13.8%. That excludes cash. One thing I want to highlight, the global equity performance here, it looks pretty underwhelming across the board. From this endpoint, where you've seen pretty concentrated names drive a lot of the index performance, some names that are active managers don't hold or hold at a much lower weight. They haven't kept up as much. They tend to protect more on the downside. We had Makita run some numbers, and if you look back over the last 5 years, the three-year rolling return for our global equity composite has outperformed the benchmark 80% of the time. So, this isn't our managers aren't behaving in a way that's unexpected or overly concerning for this current market environment that we've been in. Emerging market equity, you see that kind of one-month pop that we talked about from that China stimulus, 6.4% over the last month. Year-to-date, as Ryan mentioned, the portfolio is up 9.2%. That's an investment gain of $176 million. This chart, one thing I wanted to mention, so with that big distribution we received from Lone Star, our benefit payments have been 100% covered by our private asset inflows since 2018. I think that depending on if the board approves the new asset allocation that Makita is going to talk about momentarily, if we start making new private credit commitments, new private equity commitments in the coming year, the role of private credit and private equity in our portfolio are going to be somewhat different. So this chart may be something that goes away next year as we move forward. Safety reserve as of 9:30, you see we're pretty overweight. That was driven by that large distribution from Lone Star. As Ryan mentioned, we did some rebalancing action at the beginning of this month. We looked out through the end of November, or November 22nd, where we'll have about $10.2 million in net inflows to the portfolio, which gave us about $40 million to distribute across the portfolio. We refilled our fixed income allocations, and aside from high yield, where we've been kind of monitoring that manager and looking at it a little more closely.
The only thing I would add there is
yeah.
that everything has already occurred on rebalancing side except for Aristotle bank loans, which is a monthly liquidity, so that
yes.
17.5 will go in at the end of the month.
And the other thing I guess I'll mention, the reason we looked through November 22nd, from November 22nd on through the end of the year, we'll have about $30 million of net outflows. With the new asset allocation that's being presented today, the amount that we would be decreasing emerging market equities and emerging market debt would be equivalent to about $30 million. So we kind of have a game plan for where we'll source those flows towards the end.
The drop in the flows, again, we were using a $9 million. I mean, there was a $9 million number kind of off the net monthly versus 8.3. And so.
Yeah, it's been kind of dropping over time. I think it was like 8.9 last year. So it's.
So we take the average of the actual last three to project out. So. It kind of moves along with what's been changing.
Yeah, I mean, the contributions coming in have been higher. I think benefit payments out monthly has been pretty consistent, but I think the biweekly that we get from the city, you know, went from below $9 million every 2 weeks. It's been like $9.5 million, I think, averaging the last few months. So more contributions coming in. Obviously, that number can change once an APC is in place as well. So we'll talk more about the safe reserve and that allocation when we get into asset allocation. That's been a big topic with, you know, the purpose of that and the benefit gap decreasing further over time.
Any other questions on the portfolio rebalance?
Well, I always point this out, but go back to 269, we'll roll with Mark because he's the whole thing about the injured patient who's in rehab. they've still been able to perform some of their duties, and they've produced horrible IRRs for the last 7 years, but they have filled this need where they've funded 100% of our benefit outflows. And then had we gone ahead and sold everything fire sale back in 2016, our IRRs would look great, much better than they are now, but we would have had to have sold hundreds of millions of dollars of good pension assets in order to fund this. This would this 6 year period, a 7 year period, how much dollar wise, Ryan, is that approximately? Well, I guess it's 700 million. Okay. Yeah, there's a 700 million. We would have had to sell public equity, public debt in order to fund this. Instead, we've taken this wounded car victim, and they've produced horrible IRRs that have been an absolute negative impact on all reported rates of return, but they have served this one need incredibly well, which is just really a mismatch we have with our the size of our liability, the number of people who are receiving that, relative to the number of people that are paying in right now, which is an issue that we have. Kelly mentioned earlier, we need to have more people paying into the system in order to get to where we need to go. But it's always, I think, important to highlight this thing and just how detrimental it would have been had we had to sell good long-term pension assets in order to fund this thing, which we would have had to have done. There was no plan B on having to fund these obligations.
Yeah, we ran some.
One point I'd like to make on this, because it's important, because the criticism that we may have is I would love for somebody to come in and second guess what we've done and try to explain how they would have done things differently and what the results would have been. If I were the commerce guy, I would not want to come here.
We should have liquidated those bad assets. We should have got rid of them, and so we'd have better, we'd have better returns, and we could show the world, look at our returns, they're so good. But in the meantime, we're down hundreds of million.
Yeah, I mean, we'd have gotten a fraction of what you wanted.
Yes. I mean, it would have been a tremendous loss, but that
would have been worse.
Underscores his lack of understanding.
You should anticipate that and create a graph and say, anticipate that and say, because that will be his answer, right? And so you can see.
We ran a hypothetical analysis. There's a lot of ifs, but if we would have sold the entire private portfolio for 50 cents on the dollar, which probably was not doable given the amount of, hair on some of those assets, the ADC annually going forward would be about 45 million higher than what the state's looking at.
At least.
We would have been at a much lower asset base. So even if we were earning 8%, we wouldn't be able to catch up because.
Yeah. So mathematics.
There would be a lot of fact checking, trust me.
Well, I'm just saying that we should, before he comes in, we should kind of figure out where we really want to, will it be an open meeting? Will it be a public setting, public meeting? Okay. So I guess my point is we need to probably be very deliberate on the points we want to make sure that the, maybe the press will be here, who knows, the city council people will be here, but those bullet points that we want to make sure are repeated. And so if there is whatever, point we want to hone in on correct him or school him, we should probably think about that beforehand. And I don't know if it's allowed to coordinate. I don't know.
We can do whatever y'all want. It'll be an open public meeting. We'd like to invite the IAC. We'd like to put some time constraints on it. Maybe we'll do the moment of silence before or afterwards. I don't know.
It will be one body on the floor.
And it'll be a free with some constraints, and you guys have the opportunity to make points, ask questions, whatever you want to do. And we should be good listeners and then good feedback providers.
And I think it's important if this is going to be an ongoing thing, if they do get hired to do an ongoing project, which is what they were pushing for,
it's good for them to hear from you all on what you really think are the important issues that they need to consider going forward. Not just, we didn't like the past report, but here's how you think about it.
So getting back to this chart, I mean, aside, you know, the, you know, having to have, what was critical also in this is our reserve. We went into our reserve several times as we were, things were becoming liquid. And, you know, that is our conservative way of how we had to do things going forward. Also underscoring that we couldn't take risks and we couldn't invest because our reserve was used throughout this period as well.
Yep.
So I just want to make that point too.
And I mean, as assets were coming back when we were
and replenishing, but it was
we intentionally made the choice to rebuild the fixed income and the most conservative part of the portfolio first because we had a lot of risk assets on the private side.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I would ask Leo, when you present, I'd like to know, since the private asset reserve was your suggestion, which was a great suggestion, my recollection is the first meeting, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I would like to know what you believe would be the right conditions that you aspire to. And you say, hey guys, it's time to go back to an asset allocation that does not include safety reserve. So just if you can bake that into your comment.
All right, well, we'll do that. We're going to have Tom, if there's no other questions, provide a review of the IAC meeting last month, and then we'll move on to the asset allocation from there.
Okay.
The IAC meeting, we had portfolio update, specific areas, Motor Scott global equity underperformance versus the core benchmark, as was discussed, as well as the Loomis high yield was discussed. Staff indicated that there would likely be a high yield search going forward. Then we, one of the questions that came out during the meeting was to ask Makeda, this is a point in time, provide a 10-year rate of return, a year-to-date as of August 31st, 2024, relative return contribution regarding quartile and median return universe of similar fund size to the Dallas Fund. And that's to be delivered at some point. Then we did an asset allocation update. We talked about timelines, agreement of a 4% allocation to private credit, 1% increase to private equity, target allocation, high yield, bank loans, EM debt combined into a single public credit asset class, and global equity and EM equity combined into a single public equity asset class. Then we talked about Huff Energy and a lot of discussion. Bottom line, it was agreed by the IAC move Huff to its own asset class with a zero target. This would allow a proposed target allocation of 6% for private equity. And we took an official vote on this, and it was unanimous that in favor of recommending the asset allocation change, including the Huff reclassification to the board for consideration and approval. Another area that was talked about was private market diligence and the process by staff, including pacing, sourcing, and due diligence. And there's a lot of logistics involved in a process like this. And rather than try and herd a group of IAC members, it felt it might be more prudent and more effective to have a working group, like an asset class committee. And this could be made up of anywhere from one to three IAC members with expertise in that area, as well as staff, CIO, and so forth. This was also recommended as a good way to go, and consideration of the due diligence involved and the ODD involved in the process. Finally, we talked about potential investment policy statement amendments, and especially with a new long-term asset allocation and other challenges from the private markets program. A number of thoughts brought in, rebalancing, approval diligence process, incorporated as well PRB suggestions, and then staff would expect and plan for approval sometime in November. And that is what I have. Any other comments from the folks over there?
I think that it was a very good conversation. I unfortunately missed a little bit at the beginning, but I do think we did cover a lot of things. I do think the subcommittee for the privates will also be helpful because it would just complement, you know, with staff and with Alborn and so forth. So I think that was also good. I also think that the husk scares me a little bit. I'm going to say that because allocating it as zero, I just want to make sure that we're above reproach in our methodologies about how we look at the universe, and putting them to zero only concerns me. And I think about it often about, like, are we doing anything that would seem kind of, I don't know, suspect to anybody on the outside? I understand that we want to look at privates a little bit more actively. And in doing that, we will always be sitting with that big chunk, and it will always prevent us from looking at a proper allocation for a private equity particularly. So I do think that's really important because I do think we're getting to that point, especially if, as the ADC comes into play. But I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I do think that it was a very, very, very great meeting and proactive about how we're looking at privates, how we're classifying things now, and the process, and also implementing it in the investment policy as well.
And we'll talk more about the HUF today as part of the asset allocation.
I
would say we looked at a lot of options, and I feel like what we're proposing with
HUF, I think it's fair,
is we're not putting it in some kind of vague energy, you know,
yes,
legacy. The allocation is literally going to be called HUF Energy. It's you know, for that investment until it liquidates.
And I actually think it also has the advantage to say, like, this is a legacy asset that we can't, it's a zombie. Like, you know what I mean? Is it a zombie? You know what I mean? Like, that's my point. It's like, what do we do with some of these legacy assets that people want to kind of tether throughout saying, why haven't you done something with it? I mean, like, you can't.
How much percentage? I'm sorry, I missed, I was traveling internationally, so I missed the AIC meeting, but how much does HUF, percentage-wise, how much does it
it's
make
of
the 6%?
It's big.
It's all the 6.
It's 100% of
the 6. The valuation on it right now is $120 million, so it's about 6% of the $2 billion. The proven.
And when you looked at we're allocating 4% to private credit, that's a lot. That's all of it.
Yeah, and that was kind of the issue with the private equity. It would consume the entire private equity allocation with IntelliEdge.
Right.
So,
I got it.
Oh, we all have an uncle like this. We go in their own category.
The only thing I was going to add on. The only thing I was going to just add to the subcommittee discussion for everybody here was, because the nature of investing in these private assets in terms of the funds that you have to be somewhat nimble in the timing.
Mm-hmm. The pacing, yeah.
Everybody's scheduled to have a meeting to say, we want to go into this fund or this allocation.
Yeah.
So maybe later on, we're going to miss opportunity. So
yeah.
The concept of the subcommittee is just to be a little bit more responsible.
I love that.
You know, give the board, but it wouldn't stop the process.
And one other thing that I just want to really point out is that the thoughtfulness about how we're approaching private markets is really quintessential because of our history. So the way we're approaching it is being very thoughtful, very methodical, and then putting a process in play and having checks and balances along the way. So I commend that because we need to do that.
And although Alborn was elected specifically because we want to be, you know, conservative and doing it right, I think it helps that there's another layer of proactive investment on our end.
That's a good extension
to
staff in terms of.
Good, exactly.
And so the subcommittees are like whoever has time or
expertise.
Yeah,
probably. Like by sector.
By sector, if depends on what committee you're comfortable with. But the way these committees have been set up before, you bring in IEC members that have expertise in that area.
Okay.
Period. And you complement that with staff.
Okay.
Yeah, we also have an item after asset allocation to kind of review what we talked about at the IAC with the subcommittee approach. Because we would plan to incorporate that into the IPS based on the feedback, kind of private market provisions. And anyway.
Thank you.
All right, so Leo, over to you on the asset allocation. I'll follow up with some implementation items. I think you need, yeah, there you go.
Sure.
All right, so good morning. I'll pick up on asset allocation, and Nick, I will hit on your comment about the safety reserve. So a lot has changed. If you look at this page, the pre-Mikita hire policy is essentially what you had at the beginning of 2018. And even if you were to go back a couple of years prior, it would have been even much more different with higher allocation to liquids and essentially very limited stock and bond holdings. Those were the ones that began to take assets as you sold the portfolio of illiquids around 2016-17. My understanding is the ones you couldn't sell, there was no market for, pricing was very weak, those are the ones that remain, essentially the more troublesome assets, some of which you discussed have been one of those. And so the first change going to 2018, you'll see a few things. First of all, simplification of the credit portfolio, elimination of the GAA, the asset allocation mandates, increase in public equities, and the establishment of the safety reserve. It's not called as such, but it is that short-term investment grade bonds. Essentially, you had no defense. You only had a little bit in cash and a little bit in short-term bonds at the beginning of 2018. You had no cash, basically. You were pretty much locked up in liquids, and then you were invested mostly in equities with a limited balance and in credit. And so we did a lot of analysis at the time. We're looking at liabilities. We look at uncertainties. Recall that about a year prior, there was this new set of contribution plans from the city, and there were two options being considered at the time or evaluated. So there were a lot of uncertainties, and to us, being able to immunize, essentially go to sleep every night knowing, hey, we have the cash separate, we can pay the next 30 months off benefit payments, no matter what happens to our portfolio, to the markets, or anything else, that cash is ready. That allowed the rest of the portfolio to be built to one row by investing in equities to work out the problem assets that still lingered. I'll still come back to your point in a bit, Nick. If we move then towards the right, you'll see about 3 years later, we did another one of these studies in which a few things took place. One, reduced emerging markets, both in the equity and in the fixed income space. And with now more certainty, more limited legacy assets, more clarity on contributions, et cetera, we were able to cut back the safety reserve from roughly 15% of the fund to about 9%. And then you have what we're looking at today, which Tom very well summarized there. Minor changes compared to the prior two times, the creation of new composites by aggregating all of the public equities into one category, and the same thing for credit, the establishment of a new private credit as a class. You had invested in the past, you had an allocation, you had holdings, those have matured or been sold by and large, say for one tiny position. The reduction of natural resources from 5 to 3, which has been in the works. And minor adjustments, for example, on the listed equity coming back about 2 points on emerging markets. So we'll explore that in more detail, but it's something that, you know, at the investment committee level, we've spent some time and we've shared some of these analyses in the past. So now it's coming formally to you for action later today. On the next page, you have an schematic of a chart looking at the actual asset allocations. Prior page was targets, this was actual. And what you see here starts with the blue at about 20-25% was what you had in listed equities. And that's about double over 7 years. Real assets were, you know, roughly 30-35%. Those have come down to about less than half that amount. The fixed income, which was quite large, included more rate-sensitive assets and credit, has been cut back a bit, primarily the public credit category. A lot of the structured credit and emerging market has gone away. And the green is the one that hasn't changed too much. We had some realizations there, but it was the slowest moving of the illiquid categories in terms of redeeming some of those legacy positions, with half being the larger standout still, and then we'll start the second one. So a lot of these I covered already, and Brian did as well, but this is good background, you know, if you ever need to refer, for example, the third bullet, you know, explains the reasons for the establishment of the safety reserve around May of 2018 and towards November. On the bottom, I had alluded to, okay, if there was all of these changes that are being approved, how are you going to implement those? We started from the lower risk categories to the higher risk one in terms of filling those mandates. Legacy assets continue to be a headwind. We knew that coming in. Yeah, very transparent. There was a ton of information throughout the RFP process back in 2018. You post all of your materials. You disclosed what you owned, what you did, and what you were hoping to do. And one thing that we noted at the time was that, you know, you had two options. It's more or less the topic that we're addressed today. One was, okay, let's sell them as fast as we can and get as much as we can today and hope to invest and with all those monies that can get a market rate of return, try to make up from those losses that we'll have to accept when we sell those positions. Or plan B is, okay, if there's no good market or the price is too steep, the discount is too high, let's hold and try to work through those. And, you know, it's going to take some time. And eventually we'll get more money that way than if we had to sell very quickly today. So our view is that, you know, you can do both. You got to choose one or the other. Obviously, the second was the one chosen for those assets that could not be sold at a reasonable discount. And our view is that, you know, it's going to take at least 5 to 7 years to get to less than 10%. We're almost on that range now. We're getting close. So I think from that perspective, you know, there is no, not easy. It takes a lot of work. Staff has worked tremendously hard. I know the board, some board members were also very involved, especially in the first years. So I think we're towards a good trend. I think, you know, one big position in real estate, one big position in private equity, once those two come down, then I would think that legacy assets, at least category, would be minor. So we got two more to work through. And so, Nick, to your point, the safety reserve has many uses. Some client of ours have it even without any legacy issues. It's just, it's a feel-good category. It's knowing, you know, I'm going to prepay or segregate, if you will, the assets that I don't need to prepay, especially if I have a very negative cash flow situation. And then I can invest the rest to generate stronger returns, because now I won't have to potentially sell those positions, so I can take more liquidity. My view is, once these two positions truly move, we will revisit and discuss if there is a need or not at that time.
We've gotten a little bit of a break because short-term interest rates were not so much.
Yeah.
So there wasn't the negative spread you would normally have. But if we go back to a more normal yield curve, then there should be, there's a higher cost to having it.
That's right. The opportunity cost in the first few years was high. So if short-term rates were making 1% on average, right? Now you're making 5%, that's a big difference. So for now, the view is we'll keep this because we still have some uncertainties. We're now making good return on these short duration holdings. But the intention is, as we do this at least every 3 years, if not more often, we will review it at the next cycle.
Yeah, I mean, long-term rates, 2.5, 3 is what I'm seeing, is sort of the projected. So we should be thinking that'll be safe reserve, say, 1 to 2 years from now, and then think of it in that context.
Yeah.
And I mean, we looked at peer asset allocations when we were going through this process, and I would say With the safety reserve and investment grade bonds, we have 13% of the portfolio in cash or investment grade. That's lower than most peers have. So I would say we would look at the duration of that fixed income portfolio, but I don't think we're too conservative by any means on what we have and kind of the cash and short or cash and investment grade bonds. We might move more to Longfellow. We might look at a treasury allocate. You know, there's lots of different things we could do, but as that 9% gap becomes 4 or 5, once we get into the ADC period, we're going to have more private market outflows, but, you know, we'll, I think the time to look at that is probably the next cycle.
And in theory, it was really just a product of the liquidity that we had for our private, right? So is that, that's diminished materially or?
No, it was more of a product of, like, how we got to 30 months was 30 months net benefit outflows, and then we lowered it to 18 months.
Okay.
So it was more, you know, we had less in liquid assets to be able to sell in 2018, so that should be, that's kind of part of the rationale, but the size of the portfolio is more based on benefit outflows and how much it was tied up in private.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say we evaluate it more as the benefit gap goes from 6 to 3 versus, you know, our private allocation to a point we can handle it now.
Mm-hmm.
That's 4%.
So the thought is in about 2 years we'd reevaluate.
Yeah. And if I think, you know, we get to the end of 25 and something changes materially on kind of how much is coming in, maybe you would do it sooner, but at least 2027 asset allocation.
But even if something happens, it would just be a smaller portion of a book.
Yeah,
size, so it may not even do anything, right?
Over time. We were looking at some numbers early on, and the 110 a year gap, when it's in, I think, McKee's liquidity analysis, kind of goes from 110 to 75 by year 3 to 30 to 40 gap per year at the end of that 5-year period.
Yeah. It's a more, yeah.
So then there was another instance when we collectively reviewed and discussed asset allocation. That was when Senate Bill 322 came to be, and that was the first instance in which there was the need to conduct an additional reporting once every 3 years or so. And we had 4 recommendations that related to asset allocation that we include in this report as a summary or recap, if you will. The first one is agents don't change asset allocation yearly, constantly. You're always chasing yourself otherwise, like a dog chasing its tail. And so be strategic, come up with a long-term plan, and then give yourself time to execute. Of course, revisit that periodically and change when there is a material need to do so, as opposed to do it constantly. And look, the bottom three have to do more with contributions, with actuarial, with assumptions, and basically saying, yeah, investments are important, but all of these are at least as, if not more important. So monitor contribution levels versus the benefits, consider plan design changes if something is not working, and during these years you did change a few things, for example, the assumed rate of return assumption. So that's that. Then if you move to the next 2021, I already went through some of those, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but they're documented on this page. And here is, you know, what happened over the last year, essentially prepping up for today, including reviewing assumptions, reviewing a lot of other mixes, and the reclassification of the half energy to create some space. Otherwise, Tina, you made a good observation. If it lingers for many more years, then you're in a sense stuck unless you do something about it. And if you cannot sell it and you cannot write it down to zero or some other figure, then it lingers in there. And so this is one way that, you know, it was discussed and evaluated in this group, staff along with us, with the investment committee, to try to come up with a workaround that is transparent, is reasonable, is prudent, and has a good chance of helping the system overall.
The other thing, too, which I also think, I'm sorry I'm talking out loud, but I kind of think about it as we speak about it, because it allows us to also, at some point in time, consider whether it really does need to be written down in a time when you know, it won't affect the overall health of the fund in such a material way that people can say that we're kind of done all we can to try and get rid of it and not change it. You know, I
know what you mean,
but I'm afraid to say it.
It's going to be hard to take a 6% loss, but we do have it valued at the best number we can. We don't, you know, never want it to be over or undervalued. So we haven't written it down because we think it's at the right value. With, you know, granted, we don't have a lot of it. So we're not holding on to it because we don't take the law. And I
agree with that. I agree with that. I agree with that. But, yeah.
Yeah, it would be nice if we could take a 6%
if we're,
and not impact it.
If we were using the GP's value, it would be closer to 10% of the portfolio.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So the next section, I'll skip most of the pages because they deal with the current market environment. We go through those typically at every meeting. Your staff also provides some updates about, you know, interest rates, what's going on in the market. I will just pick two slides. This is one. So with the current level of interest rates, even if they come down back to that 2 or 3%, we're still doing better than over most of the last decade. So we would expect that returns from this point forward are going to be somewhat more favorable than they were in the past. Here's one chart that shows, you know, the efficient frontier essentially the least of most asset classes would be expected to produce somewhat higher returns than they did over the last decade. And this is the second chart. So this one shows, if I focus on the line, what is the likelihood of making 7%? Picking 7 because that's closest to industry average. And we had the conversation earlier with the actuaries. The average today is about 6.91%. 7 is the right number to use the calculation, but we could plot any number. The story here won't change. Starting in the year 2000, interest rates were cut. They never really came up. That triggered investors which had 8 or above percent rate of return assumptions to really move into the few asset classes that were expected to produce those high returns in a 0 or quasi-0% cash rate environment. And that was a lot of the move into hedge funds and into private markets. With one, you get some upside with limited or no downside, as it was sold on the hedge fund side. And with private equity, you can get double-digit returns.
What's the deviation? Like, if you were to have a 60% chance to hit 70% in 2023, but what's that deviation? You have a 60% chance, but you also have a certain chance to do the risk profile of that. Is there such a thing as deviation of what the downside risk of trying to hit that mark would be?
Yes, and you know, we have some stats like that when we go into our section, because we model also what is the likelihood for this fund with this current allocation or the one that is recommended to hit to meet or exceed that 6.5%. And there's obviously some variability around it. Yeah.
Are you seeing a deceleration of plans lowering their assumption rates? Because I'm sure that they made major adjustments, but do you see just a small, like, are most plans trying to get to that point, like that 6.9, and is that achievable? In other words, that they're not going to drop more?
Yeah. So if you look at the map, or the chart, not the map, it had been, let's see, if you go back to 2000, it was kind of a steady at that 8 to 8.5%, right? So I do it from your side. And then it begins to trickle down, fairly constantly when you look at the average. And it seems that starting in 2023, when interest rates came, it plateaued.
Yeah.
Nobody has really, nobody. Very few had made changes in the last 18 months or so,
okay,
2 years. Most kept it because, okay, there's no need to do any further cuts or adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
Rates began to go up, so now we have better likelihood than in the past to meet our numbers. But nobody increased them because, hey, there's no certainty that we're going to remain at a 5% level or so for cash. So let's wait and see. We're in a good place, and let's maintain that. So my expectation is going to be not a lot of changes. If rates come back to that 2, 3% more normal level, we may be in a pretty flattish environment where, you know, most investors will be somewhere between 6.5 to 7.25 on the higher end. There's always going to be some outliers. But that's the range that I'm seeing. And, you know, the Nasra study was mentioned. You know, it's public information. It shows that. And, you know, Most commonly 7%, but above 7.25%. There's not some news, not too many. Not too many.
Any ideas for what the current assumption rate is that people are using going forward?
Yeah, that's the one. 6.91 is average.
Okay.
The median is 7. And, you know, above 7.5 is pretty much nobody. It's very, very few. So, you know, it seems like that rate of, you know, high 6 is where we are now. High 6 to low to 7 is the most common assumed rate of return for, you know, funds out there.
But the assumption for inflation that goes into that?
Oh, yeah. Funds
for, like
2.5%? Yeah, somewhere in there between 2.5%, 2.6%, 2.8%, depending on the provider. There is the Horizon, which reports in August the metrics for 40 or so providers, large consultants and other, you know, big banks and so forth. Those are where the numbers are every August, every report. So a few months it came out and it was around that. Yeah. Okay. So very quickly, let me see. Colin will do the next section. So just a few reminders. What we're predicting here, what we're talking is this is a long-term average annualized expectations. So this is not meant to be happening on any single year or on any 1 year. It's not a yearly study, if you will. We put some additional color here as to how we do it. I will skip through this in the interest of time, but the reality is that when you forecast a few things, it's a little bit easier. So bonds with yields, it's a little bit easier. When you're talking about real estate, for example, you know, there's a lot more that goes into estimating returns, and we, you know, are transparent and show our track record in doing this. You know, when we're looking at 20 years, you have to wait a long time to get some figures. So we're beginning to see those now because we began to track these better starting the year 2000 or so. So if you look at high yield, that's pretty much spot on. On the next page, we have the other main categories, stocks in the U.S., developed markets and emerging markets and private equity. So in general, I would say reasonable. And if you average all of these into an asset class, I would say, you know, the assumptions have been pretty reasonable with no surprises, if you will. Oh, you were way optimistic or way under. I would say the orange is the realized return after seeing 20 years of data. The two that, you know, had the biggest error, if you will, errors, have been emerging market equity, where most investors anticipated better returns than ultimately materialized during a 20-year period, and bonds with rates coming down way lower than most anticipated, you know, 20 or so years past, and staying there longer than expected. Called after 08 or 09, everybody said, oh, rates are about to increase. It took over 10 years for rates to actually turn and go up meaningfully. But others have been pretty much spot on, including U.S. equity and private equity, for example, which tend to be very large weights for most investors. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Colin to go in more detail over what's recommended to you today.
Sounds good. Thank you, Leo, and good afternoon, everyone. I'll go ahead and jump one more page. I have some great background on what this plan has done over the past several years and what goes into our assumptions and models. I'm going to go ahead and touch on the recommendation today and then go through some supporting slides. This table right here is the meat and potatoes of what the recommendation is for the policy. You can see on the left-hand side the current policy, and then on the right-hand side there the recommended policy. And we try to highlight what a lot of the changes were. Leo went through some of that earlier, but I'll go through it now. First, I'll start off with those red numbers. That's the asset classes that are being reduced. First and foremost is the natural resources allocation. That is naturally coming down over time from 5% to 3%. And so that change is highlighted here. Other asset classes that are being reduced would be public credit. That's coming down to 11% from 12%. Public equity is coming down 2% to 58% from 60%. Within public equity and private credit, you can see that those asset classes have been combined into an aggregate. Before, on the equity side, it was global equity and emerging markets equity. separately. Those have been combined into one asset class here with a single target. That creates some flexibility and consistency within the allocation. The same thing is done on the public credit side. You can see high yield bonds, bank loans, and emerging markets were individual targets before. Those have been combined into a single public credit aggregate with a single 11% target. Again, that creates a lot of flexibility, consistency within those asset classes. Private equity has been marginally increased from 5% to 6%. And then one of the biggest changes here is the addition of the private credit asset class. As you know, that target has been added at 4%. The safety reserve remains the same. You can see at the very bottom of the recommendation here under fixed income and cash, as well as short-term bonds, those allocations stay the same. The other thing I will point on at is within the public equity and public credit asset classes that were combined, there's an implied reduction within the emerging markets allocation because both of those asset classes have been reduced by one. So that is implied within those aggregates. The very bottom of this chart shows our expected, Makita's expected returns for these different policies. You can see there's a marginal improvement over the expected return for the 10 and 20 year periods. So the first number there is the 10 year, and then there's a little dash, and the other number is 20 years. So we have both of those listed there. There's a marginal improvement with the recommended policy from an expected return standpoint based on Makita's modeling. Standard deviation, both of these is very similar. There's a slight uptick, but overall pretty consistent. And at the very bottom, the probability of achieving that actuarial rate of 6.5% is listed. The recommended policy has a slightly better chance over the 10 and 20 year periods to reach that number.
On the standard deviation, just can you provide a refresher of what that means, you know, or what that implies for reversion?
Yeah, so it essentially states that, you know, there is a wide range of returns that can take place. The higher the standard deviation, the higher the range of outcomes. And so if you assume a normal distribution, you know, two-thirds of return should come within your expected return plus or minus one standard deviation. So that means you're looking at, you know, 20% to minus 6% should take place two-thirds of the time. Now, in reality, numbers are not coming up using that distribution. They tend to be more following a log normal distribution. That's a conversation we can leave for another day. But, you know, long story short, the bigger the number, the bigger the range of outcomes you can expect.
I'll go ahead and pause. If there's any questions on the recommendation, I'll take those now. Otherwise, I'm happy to jump into the supporting spots next.
Tom, do you concur with this?
I do as well as the IEC.
But I mean, on behalf of the IEC, do you?
I just, yes.
Okay. And then staff, are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay.
Great. Thank you. I'll move quickly through the remaining slides here. We just have some support. This table here shows each asset class as well as established ranges. So you can see there's an 8% band around public equity as well as a 4% band around the new public credit allocation. We also have the benchmarks for each asset class listed here. I'll just go through the main changes. Within private equity, that benchmark is being updated to the MSCI Acqui-Immini plus 2%. Previously, it was the Russell. This new benchmark has a little bit of a wider opportunity set, and it's more consistent with what other peers are using. The other change is within private credit. Again, that's a new asset class. The benchmark listed here is a 50-50 split between the high yield and bank loans, public indices. Again, that's consistent with what we're seeing across the industry for that asset class.
So the public market plus a 2 or 1.5%, we looked at several options and also the percentage added on to the public benchmark and amongst other peer plans. And the 2% private equity is consistent with what we've seen. Talked to Allborn about the 1.5 on private credit. I would say it's consistent with Makita's capital market expectations. It may be a little bit, I think a lot of people are using plus one, but it may be, you know, it's also consistent with what we would expect to earn by taking the illiquidity premium of moving our, portion of our credit from public markets to private markets.
Brian, do you know what Direct uses for their public equity benchmark?
From what I saw in one report, it was just a flat S&P 500 benchmark with no addition.
Right. I do think that they use a PME calculation on the S&P 500. It's slightly different.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different benchmarks, and I would say once we get Allborn reporting, we talked to them yesterday, I think in order to get meaningful data on private markets, you need to look at multiple different factors and benchmarks by vintage year, and they'll have private benchmarks that we'll look at in addition to the public proxy.
I have one question.
Yes.
Hey, Nick?
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, just a question. Is there, a good part of the reason on what we decided earlier and bringing them in to get a chance to talk to them, is to just show respect to the council and let them know that we're listening. If we're going to be doing some of these changes anyway, is there any sense in getting some credit for that anyway and maybe sharing with them that, we brought these folks in to talk to them, we've reviewed this, we're going to be making some changes. If it's happening anyway, can we get some credit for it with them for doing it?
Oh, I don't want him to think that we're doing it because he says anything. So I clearly have an issue with that because these are we go as business as normal, and for him to even think that we have making changes or we are just changing our MO just because he's mentioned anything about this concerns me highly.
Well, could we word it in a way where it doesn't sound like that, but that they still see that we're being responsive and listening to them? I don't know. I'm just wondering if we can get any credit.
That's the key, listening to them. They have nothing to say.
Wow.
I think it's more a case of continuing to be proactive rather than reactive. All inputs matter, and we filter and gauge them accordingly.
Yeah.
So his report, which we've all listened to or read in some form, is an input.
Yeah.
So the answer is that it's been a relevant input and may have guided us slightly or not.
Yeah, we take it into consideration. Yeah. It's just one of many resources that we consider. Not dramatically, but
all right.
A question.
So this is your
Tony.
To the dance.
Sorry, Tony. I just can't. This is my ire. I just can't. I'm sorry. I'm not productive as a trustee when it comes to this point. But anyway, getting back to the allocations, that the change of allocations, when I saw, I think it was private equity went from 5 to 6. Does that take in consideration? We're taking Huff out, and that 6 is open.
That 6 is partially open. So we're leaving the rest of the private equity, including Lone Star, in there because we feel that's more private equity exposure. So
yeah.
I think we're at about 3 right now, so it opens up a little bit, but we're still moderating what we can do going forward based on liquidations in the remaining portfolio.
Okay, fair.
I do think it's important, though. I get the point that some are saying. In some ways, at the end of the day, our goal is to make sure that this pension fund is strong and is adaptive. And to me, this is a shining example of a process of using a board, staff, and its consultants to adapt. And I think this is what we do. And at the end of the day, if someone wants to speak it, we're all ears for it. But this is a part of our standard operating procedure of looking at what's going on. So I laud this because that shows us looking at using our consultants and adapting.
Again, my concern is that we just increase the legitimacy of someone who's been pounding table about private equity, and we actually would have done this anyway.
This is not any reflective of the spirit.
Oh, okay.
This is just us. This is us.
Yeah, so that's unfair.
This was started, Tina, way before.
Oh, I agree, but you know how the spin goes.
And it happens to
me. You know how the spin goes.
So,
like you say, about gambling and casinos.
Right.
All right. The next slide here, I think, is an important one. This looks at the recommended policy's expected return based on Makita's asset allocation assumptions or capital market assumptions for each of these years. So right now, the recommended policy's expected return over 10 years, as I mentioned earlier, is 7.1%. If you looked at that same policy last year, based on our capital markets assumptions, it would have been 8.1, so on all the way back down to 2018 here. So as you can see, a single year's capital market assumptions can have a pretty significant impact on what that expected return is. You can see there's a number of years here where that expected return for this same policy would have been below 6%. Right now, with where yields are, those returns look really, the expected returns look really strong, but that's not always been the case, and you can just look back at even recent history and see that. So this is something that we think is important to look at, and we always caution clients against making drastic changes based on a single year's capital market expectations. And that's another reason why we think the marginal changes for this asset allocation policy make a lot of sense. We don't think drastic changes based on a single year are worth doing. The next page here looks at the question of private equity. This recommended policy is settled at a 6% allocation, but what if we doubled that to 12% and took that extra 6% from public equity? What would happen to the expected return? And you can see it's pretty marginal. The expected return with private equity at 6% is 7.1%. If you double the private equity allocation, it only goes up to 7.3%. So it's pretty minor, even though you're completely doubling that private equity allocation.
I'm going to ask an obvious question, but does increasing the private equity allocation decrease the risk?
It does, and that's the other point of this. It does not. And if you look at the expected volatility at the bottom, it actually increases the risk. And so by a less degree than the actual expected return goes up.
There's a couple. Go ahead, Tom. I was just going to say you got to define risk. I mean, if you're defining risk by price volatility, that's one thing. I mean, what about just, you know, risk of loss or risk of lack of control in a public versus private setting too? I mean, I think you got to define risk. There's multi dimensions of risk.
Yeah, right. Point that you're referring to the Huff effect. I think that's a good observation. I think you're only talking about price.
I was going to say that, yeah, the definition of risk matters. Risk to me means more than one outcome will take place, and, you know, and so that's uncertainty. And as you go into illiquid assets, there's a wide range of outcomes that can take place, so that's one way to view it. The other one is, you know, the volatility, you know, just because it's wrapping a private wrapper, it's going to be marked to market at most once a quarter, which means, you know, the observed or realized volatility is going to be much lower than what is actually embedded in the actual holdings of those assets. And so those assets will have leverage, they will be riskier, they will be, you know, smaller with more operational issues. And so from that perspective, I view an increase in private equity as up in the risk as opposed to decreasing the risk.
I would concur with that. There's a concept that people use called volatility laundering, which is just to that point, yeah. Which is that the marks on private equity really is apples and oranges with the trading markets and how prices move, because it's very subjective, not subject to price discovery. And, you know, you're seeing the fact that 2022, 23, and 24 distributions on private equity are a drought compared to what they were years before.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you haven't seen prices move that much, which says to me that there is something that's not being marked accordingly. So.
And it's just a bigger market in general. There's been more money chasing these type of investments. And so the qualities of the investments have been come under a little bit of fire, but.
But we're looking forward to a real thorough review of all the private equity classes. There's a lot of newer, nuanced ones, continuation funds, secondary funds, different things that are emerging that are all worthy of evaluation in addition to
just traditional private equity funds.
Yep.
So the last thing we have is to look at liquidity. Obviously, what we did is we looked at, you want to move to the next page? One more. Essentially, what we did is we looked at, can you withstand increases to liquid asset classes? And even though the changes are not huge, you know, we're talking about 5-3% delta, right? You decrease 2 in real assets and you increase 4 in credit and 1 in private equity. What does it do to you in an adverse environment? Well, we're doing here something worse than the global financial crisis. You know, detail on the prior page, but you'll see that yes, your illiquids will increase because those will typically get scale, not move much. The rest of the book, essentially, your public equity goes down in value. And so the denominator effect means that, hey, my holdings now increase in value on the percentage of the total fund for the liquid assets. And they go to about 35-36%. And so that means you have lower liquidity, but still have plenty. Over half of your portfolio remains liquid, even under worse environment than the global financial crisis. So that gives us a lot of comfort that you can withstand this allocation and you have plenty of liquidity to operate even if we hit something worse than the global financial crisis. So that pretty much concludes the presentation. We have other slides in here, but I know I think it's overdoing it at this point. We're happy to take any questions if you have any.
We've talked about a lot of these concepts already, but we have a few kind of implementation consideration slides, and then we'll seek approval to move forward with asset allocation. We already covered this. We've talked about the new benchmarks. Reclassifying Huff kind of talked through this as well, but we just don't feel like the underlying exposure really is private equity. It's not going to move like private equity. It's energy exposure. It's proven undeveloped acreage in the Eagle Ford Shale. So the recommendation is to move it to its own asset class. It still falls within under the equity asset class, but it's titled Huff Energy, which frees up some room for new investment in the private equity asset class. Spend the most time on this. Asset class structures, we're recommending to combine emerging market equity into global equity to one public equity asset class. Same thing on public credit, where we're recommending high yield bank loans and EM debt to combine into one 11% public credit allocation. There's a provision in the investment policy right now that will do a asset class structure review on any asset class that has multiple underlying strategies. So right now it's only been on the public equity portfolio because we've had a more siloed approach in credit where we have a single allocation for each strategy manager. So going forward, we would have these structure reviews both in public credit and public equity. What they outline is manager strategy allocations, targets, any implementation considerations. On the next page, we have an example of kind of what we did on the public equity side. We did structure reviews in 2020, 2021, 2023. That's where we came up and adjusted the active global equity targets from 8 to 6%. On the last time, we looked at style tilts of the portfolio. We looked at whether we should add passive. We looked at our small cap exposure and added U.S. and international small cap. So there's a lot of changes under the hood of the public equity portfolio that we've made through the structure reviews, which are required to go to the IAC and then to the board. So we would do the same thing on the public credit side. This allows us to be a bit more flexible. For example, in public credit, if we wanted to look at adding a multi-asset credit manager or something like that, we could do so through updating the structure review as opposed to reopening the entire asset allocation, which every 3 years. So, as we update the IPS, I want to make it a little bit more clear what the board is actually approving as part of this asset class structure right now. Public equity of a whole presentation from Makita that has kind of elements of risk controls in there. But what we want to do is take the key, you know, asset class targets, implementation considerations out of that presentation into a short policy document, which would be what the board is approving for both public equity and public credit. That would be kind of an addendum appendix to the investment policy statement that we could update on its own.
All right. So, ready to go? Ready to get a new motion? Anything else you want to say?
No, there's a lot of stuff coming up after we get this approved over the next months and quarters with updates to the IPS and then doing public equity and public credit structure reviews and then initial pacing plans on the private market side.
Okay. All right, so if we have a motion to approve the long-term asset allocation and direct staff to bring amendments to the investment policy statement, reflecting the updated asset allocation back to the board for its review and approval. Motion. First, second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Makita. Thank you, IAC. Thank you, Ryan and staff. And now, Christina, talk to us about private market diligence and approval process.
There you go.
So, you know, Tom has given a summary of the discussion around this, but as we are planning to restart our private markets program, we want to be very thoughtful about how we go about doing that. So we had a very robust discussion with the IAC on this topic. Staff's plan is to get feedback from both IAC and board and incorporate you all's feedback into the IPS revisions that we are planning to do in the coming months. So I want to point out on here that pursuant to section 4.07 of Article 62438-1, the vote of eight trustees is required to approve any alternative investments. This is part of statute. This was part of the bill that was passed back in 2017. So it's pretty unique to our fund. The conclusion of the IAC, as Tom mentioned, is that, IAC agree with the staff's recommendation to set up a small private market subcommittee comprised of perhaps 3 to 4 members, that the subcommittee can meet on a as-needed basis to review investment opportunities and make recommendations to the board. And I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about what we think the due diligence and approval process should look like. So in terms of the due diligence process, we think, and I'm sure you all agree, that pacing is extremely important. We want to have vintage year diversification. So I think that's the baseline for any private markets program. So Allborn is going to help us with developing a pacing model for each and every private market asset class. So for PE, for private credit, we're going to have a pacing model. And the number of investments and commitment amount for each investment will be based on the pacing model for the asset class. We're going to be very disciplined about sticking to the pacing model so that we can benefit from the vintage year diversification. So in terms of sourcing, we think initially we're going to leverage Allborn's research platform by focusing only on highly rated managers and funds. We may consider at a later stage as our program develops and matures a dual channel sourcing, that is for staff to source investment opportunities in addition to Allborn's sourcing channel. But that's at a later stage. And then staff and Allborn are going to collaborate by holding regular meetings to discuss market, review the forward calendar, and discuss investment due diligence and operational due diligence. And we're going to establish a GP shortlist jointly. So in terms of due diligence, we think staff and Allborn should conduct independent investment due diligence. But we're going to leverage Allborn's operational due diligence, given the robust operational due diligence capabilities of Allborn and limited staff resource. So on this approval process, so there are some key considerations. So first and most importantly is this, by statute, the vote of 8 trustees is required. And then as Tom mentioned, and as and I'm sure a lot of you know also know this, public investments, private market investments can be time sensitive, so that we need to act quickly, we need to be nimble in order for us to access best-in-class managers and opportunities, and to obtain fee breaks, and sometimes to mitigate blind pool risk. So currently, the IAC meets 4 times a year, and the IAC members' time and availability is limited.
I, 2 other things I would add, just with the IAC meetings, there's a lot of other stuff they need to be doing, such as if we have a high yield search, all these structure reviews. So we don't just have time in the day or time in the meeting to review everything and take everything through the IAC. Other factor to consider when it gets to the board level, we can't go into closed session and discuss any of these investments in detail, which will be needed on the private market side, and also kind of Allborn's reviews, write-ups, more detailed diligence. It makes sense to kind of do this at a subcommittee level and have a more abbreviated. I think when it gets to the board level, and I think everything should be driven off the pacing plan, where it's, you know, as part of the pacing plan, we recommended doing a secondary fund in 2025. Here's a secondary fund that we selected, you know, pros and cons, but a more cursory, a high level review of where it fits into the portfolio and how we got to that recommendation once before.
Yeah, so sorry, lost the presentation.
H278.
Okay. Yeah. So as we discussed with the IAC, the IAC is going to designate a subcommittee and delegate the private market approval responsibilities to a small subcommittee. However, staff is going to produce and review a quarterly pipeline report to IAC to seek their feedback and guidance. So the full IAC is always appraised of the potential investments that we are looking at. And then staff and Allborn will make investment recommendation presentations to the subcommittee during subcommittee meetings. The subcommittee meetings will be scheduled on a as-needed basis. This is going to require additional time commitment of the subcommittee members, but hopefully this is going to alleviate some of the time commitment of other committee members and make the logistics of scheduling meetings around people's schedules a little bit easy and make this to be more nimble. And then subcommittee is going to make recommendations to the board for you all's approval. So the board is going to review and approve a private market pacing plan. And then the board will review and approve the private market investment upon IAC subcommittee recommendation. So I know we've already had a lot of discussions on this topic, but I want to just pause and see if there's any additional discussions or questions.
I have a question/comment. Mm-hmm. I was going into the private equity, private credit, considering what this fund had gone through about 10 or so years ago. We want to make sure that the processes that we use are in line with the industry, and can you speak a little bit about how other funds, their process, approval process, and who's watching who, how does this compare to our peers?
I wish Q was still here. but I mean, talking to Allborn, I mean, the bigger pension plans, there's you know, so much they do that there's probably more discretion. Tom can probably speak to this at the staff level. They're much bigger plans. They're approving many more commitments per year. I think what may be unique to our governance and diligence process is per IPS, it's required that we have a dual written recommendation from staff and consultant on any new investment. I think the requirement of eight trustees once you get to the board level is definitely unique to DPFP. I would say maybe 50-50 plans of our size have kind of the IAC structure, probably not the quality of IAC members that we have, but the IAC structure that reviews investments before they go to the board.
Just to add to that, a lot of plans have incorporated in their policy document the charter, which covers all the responsibilities for subcommittees or asset class committee. What we did at ERS was we had specific IAC members that were experts in real estate or private equity, and then as a deal was brought to what consideration, we would have somebody now who was in that asset class, as well as one or two IAC members that were experts in that class to evaluate, check on the ODD, to check on the due diligence. This is a double check to make sure all the boxes are checked overall. And more often than not, they would pass. Sometimes they didn't. But generally, it was a complete vetting process. Occasionally, if there were something that was sensitive, we have counsel. But that's it.
And I think Auburn should come in and talk about like some of the standards. That outside of due diligence and what other people are doing and how they review what their process is for investment policies, how they're written up. It's not a bad idea. I do think because of the uniqueness of our plan that so many of us have to approve one of these, that despite even having less expertise, I think we should be probably involved maybe as just part of the process in some of these ideas, only just because eight of us have to approve it to make sure that it's okay. Maybe being less expert, let's say, for example, just because so many of us have to approve it. I don't know. I mean, that's a very unique situation. Not a lot of other plans have that.
Yeah. You definitely want to pay for that. That's important. So make sure everything's covered. And it's going to continue to evolve. As, for example, now we have what's called evergreen deals for a lot of private equity groups, whereas you can get in and out. And not have to be stuck for a 10 to 12 year period. So, the industry is constantly changing, and you want to definitely have access to that. And that's where all more.
Yeah.
Well, I like what I'm hearing. And if we could just make sure, to me, it's just a governance issue. Let the experts do what they need to do, but just making sure that we're papered our governance to where the vetting is proper.
Agreed.
Checks and balances.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. So that's part of the reason that we want to bring this, even though we've had a discussion with DICE, you want to bring this back to the board for you all to consider and give feedback so that we can formalize the process, incorporate these procedures and processes into the IPS going forward. So I guess this last page is just a sample IAC pipeline report. I would say this is among the public plans that we kind of looked at, this is a pretty standard practice for primary markets to for staff to review the pipeline report. Primary markets investments can be time sensitive, so we have to move along a limited timeline. So,
what's a typical timeline if we were doing?
Takes a long.
So
maybe that's a different slide.
A PE fund, they're going to have a 12 months of fundraising timeline. Given the fundraising environment we're in, some of them had extended their timeline to 18 months. But I think our challenge is that Auburn, they look at a lot of funds And since we are only going to invest in the funds that have like fully vetted, so their process is going to take some time as well. Once we have the investment due diligence and operational due diligence complete, there's going to be legal due diligence as well, which also adds to the timeline. So it's, it just really depends, but it can be a lengthy process from time to time. So that's you know, that's the time sensitiveness of nature of this business.
I think it's also the
is the legal review our counsel.
That's a good question.
Yeah, our count, I would look at it, and our outside counsel would look at it as well. Yeah. Right now, we use DLA.
Okay.
DLA pipe.
That's a good question, actually. And I suspect that some, like, I mean, not every private equity and private credit is the same, right? I mean, if we're looking at secondaries, it's a lot of vetting that had been done already in that respect, and that's a different type of vehicle. But, like, I guess it's going to be like a learning process.
I mean, I would say, as Tom said, I think it'll evolve over time.
Yeah.
While this board and this ISC hasn't made any new investments with DPFP, we have a lot of expertise. And then Christina was heavily involved in the private markets program at Fort Worth and worked with
right.
a few other private markets consultants. So she's provided, you know, good insight on what she's been doing the last 5 years.
But to your point, it's like no less than 12 months in most cases.
Sometimes like the best managers get oversubscribed.
Yes.
And in that case, you want to act quickly too. So.
And then there's also minimum investment. This might not be big enough for some for some
exactly.
funds. You know, this is a pretty small allocation.
But according to Alburn, we're going to coattail that.
I mean, I think Alburn will be working on the plan, but we'll probably be looking at about $10 million check size for private equity. Maybe a little
just
bit
small.
Bigger for like a direct lending with broader exposure or secondary fund. So I think that check size will get us into most funds that we are interested in.
So what's the amount that we'll be looking at here? I mean, at the end of the day, what's the gross amount under private credit under our most optimistic view?
So this is just a you know, sample. We don't have a pacing plan yet, but the target for private credit, for example, is 4%.
Yeah.
So that's $80 million. So we probably want to get to target over 3 years. So my, you know, back of the envelope calculation is perhaps $30 million a year over the next 3 years. So that's probably, you know, if we do $15 million a piece, that's two commitments in private credit.
One other quick point on the due diligence. I think realize that the consultants like Alborn that are working with these firms, they've worked with them over a number of years, and they've built a book of business, a book of background and, you know, site visits and the like. And then when a manager comes to the consultant says, okay, we're bringing down a new fund. See, that's usually the 12-month period.
Yeah.
But they've already done a good part of the due diligence, that's how updated, and then they've allowed the galleries of the new fund and go forward. So it's an evolving process, but it's a building process.
But I do like that you also anticipate the dual resource at some point. I do think that that's very smart as well, so I appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you.
So the plan here would be we'll incorporate these changes into IPS that you guys look at in terms of processes and subcommittee.
Brenda, initial reading of the discussion of the 2025 budget.
Yes, thank you, Nick. This is on page 228. I do. John, yeah, if you'll get us back to page 227. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Today I'm going to present the proposed 2025 budget. It looks a little different than what you've seen in the past, trying to enhance the presentation. The first thing that I want to talk about is just the budget process. Our budget is January to December. We present the budget to you in October of each year. at the October meeting. You can propose changes to the budget. The other thing that you'll do during the October meeting is authorize the budget to be posted to the website and send it to the City of Dallas. In November, members have the opportunity to comment, and the board staff can propose changes. And then at that time, the board can either decide to approve the budget or direct staff to adjust the budget and bring it back in December for final approval. I want to start by talking about some additional budget expenses that you're going to see this year. There are some one-time costs that are related to the funding process change that we'll be going through during 2025. But, you know, actuary services, legislative consultants, public relations, legal, so you'll see some additional expenses there, as well as the business administration software and imaging. We've had some conversations about that, and we'll be starting that process in earnest next year. So maybe about $1.1 million in kind of one-time costs that are in this budget. In our summary budget, we track administrative, we track professional, and we track investment expenses. This is a reminder of kind of these three broad categories. So let's take a look. Just to kind of set the stage here, there's a column for the 2024 budget, a column for the 2024 projected actual, the 2025 budget, and then variance columns, dollars and percentages, and then the rows are those categories that we talked about. So big picture, the 2025 budget is $19.3 million. And that compares to the 2024 budget of $17.4 million, or an increase of $1.8 million, or 10.3%. The majority of that increase is related to increased investment manager expenses, the pension system project, one-time expenses, and salaries and benefits. As you compare the 2025 budget to the 2024 budget, projected actual of 16.8, there is an increase of $2.4 million, or 14.6%. And again, those increases are driven by increased management fees, the system project, the one-time expenses, and salaries and benefits. As you compare the 2024 budget to the 2024 projected actual, there's a $651,000 difference. And that is primarily the imaging project that was budgeted in 2024 that has been deferred to 2025. One thing that I do want to point out, even with these increased levels here, down at the bottom, I've made a note about the 2016 actual budget. If we had taken that budget and simply applied CPI increases, that same budget would be $12 million. Or in 2017, that same budget would be $10 million. And for the admin and professional, we're here at the $8.4 million.
So just to compare, to clarify, those numbers are comparing to the admin and professional expense total because management expenses really distort the budget, right?
Yes. So much of the investment expense is totally driven by management fees. So we just wanted to look at the admin and professional.
I think this speaks to stewardship of fund resources over the constituted board that we have actually, from administrative and professional, engaged in deflationary practices while I think providing better oversight. So I think that's an important 7-year look. And on the investment side, since we're getting good returns, our dollar amount of management fees are going up on a basis point. We'll go over it later, but it's pretty flat, right? On a basis point, yeah.
Now I'd like to dig into just some of the specific categories of the budget. And let's start with salaries and benefits. Current staff level is 23. We do not expect any change in that level in 2025. Last year, our budgeted staff level was 22. As it relates to compensation, we do employ a compensation consulting expert. He did submit an annual salary structure letter, which tells us both the structure update or the range, how the range should move, as well as the increase. The range movement was 3.3, and the salary increase budget recommendation was 4.6%. For health insurance, we have been that renewed in April, so we're a little bit away from that, but they've given us a preliminary market increase estimate of 7%. Our remaining benefit insurance costs, like long-term disability, short-term disability, life, we expect no increase there. On the staff retirement plan, we're expecting a reduction, or we've been notified of a reduction from our current contribution rate of 9.38 to 9.04%. And just to look at the dollars, the 2025 budget for salaries and benefits is $3.9 million. Compared to 2024 of 3.6, an increase of 293, and when compared to the 2024 projected actual, an increase of 203, and the increase is due to the addition of one staff member, salary increases, increased benefit costs, and vacation and sick leave accruals. As we move on to the next category, and we look at professional expenses, budgeted actuary expenses are expected to increase by $59,000 when we compare with the 2024 budget. Legislative consultant expenses up by $48,000. Public relations, $50,000. Legal fees, $130,000. And that part of that relates to that administration software package project that we're working on. And then IT-related expenses from network security monitoring to pension software maintenance, business continuity, up about $47,000. Some of that is for increased level of service that we're receiving there.
That legislative consultant number, that seems really low in light of what we're going into.
That's just the increase. Yes, I'm sorry. That's just the increase. I'm trying to get back. Yeah, that's
it's
just
not
the
an addition.
Compared to
it's an addition to what we
the increase over the 2024 budget.
Oh, okay. I see.
And what's the for the legal fees for the pension administration software package? What does that encompass?
That is
licensing.
It's the review of. An outside legal review of the contract that we'll have with the firm, setting all of the requirements and making sure you don't get to the end and what you received was not what you expected to receive.
And who are we using for that?
We anticipate using a firm called Nossaman.
I've heard of them.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'd like to get a review when we get a chance. That's nothing immediate. I'd like to get a review of who we use for our legal, making sure that we are having as wide a net as possible to provide quality service.
As we move from professional, we look at IT plans and expenses. We expect to focus on two main projects next year, the pension administration software and the imaging. During the preliminary phase, administration software, which is where we're looking for vendors, doing RFPs. That preliminary phase is expense. We have $500,000 in the budget for that phase. Once we move into the development and implementation phase, we're estimating those expenses at $7 million, and they'll occur over the next 5 years. Imaging, we have budgeted $550,000 last year for imaging, but as we got into working on that project, it became very apparent that your pension admin software and your imaging really go hand in hand. And we felt like we needed to make sure when we selected that pension admin that our imaging vendor was one that would work well so we could get the best efficiency out of using imaging. So we're kind of doing those as dual projects at the same time, so we make sure that those marry up well. Investment expenses, we've kind of talked about the primary part of this budget is driven by management fees. We're expecting them to increase to $9.1 million. That's up $821,000 from the 2024 budget. And that's due to the increased market value in the plan assets. But overall, the overall fee as a percentage of the estimated average market value has remained at an average of 0.44% both for 2025 and 2024.
Has that come down or has that increased from what it was years ago?
It's come down and it's largely input of more passive exposure in the public equity portfolio some of the legacy assets not paying fees anymore, frankly. So it's not a great problem to have, but it does look good when you have a $120 million investment with no management fees on it. So,
but to your point, then we should at some point, that should be a material increase.
Yeah, and you can kind of see here, it was more on the passive exposure with the public equity coming down and some of the fee savings we got, but the private equity fee budget is going from 50,000 up to 1.2 next year.
Okay.
So again, we should see an increase.
Another large element of the investment budget expense is the portfolio operating expenses, which have legal, audit, appraisal, other. We're expecting that to increase in 2025, primarily related to legal expenses for new investment manager contracts and the private equity license.
Can you go into a little detail of what the legal, what they're doing on this? I mean, what's their role, legal?
So that would be, we budgeted for 5 contract reviews. That'll take care of part of that, and then the remaining is primarily surrounding the private equity legacy funds and potential legal action.
All those
private equity to help.
I'm sorry.
And all of those would be by DLA?
No. DLA would be doing the private investments. The public investments would be likely Jackson Walker. And then the legacy assets is really the litigation aspect of things with Haynes and Boone.
I really would like us to focus on making sure that this type of work is going through a process by which we possibly have some more vetting, RFP process and things like that, because I'm not quite certain what the how we go about making those types of decisions as to who will represent us. Is there an RFP process we go through?
No, we have got lawyers we've been using for a long time that we just continue to use, so we don't have an RFP process. There's not one in a policy.
Who makes the decision?
About hiring which lawyers to hire?
Yeah.
I guess myself and Kelly.
Okay.
As we move on and look at Harry Hines Building, I'm happy to report that our building is fully leased now and our tenants are on 5 to 10 year leases. The other thing I want to report is the this building was renovated in 2008, and the HVAC was installed at that time and is beginning to show some age. You may recall this past summer, we had no conditioners here with the second floor. So we have decided to, if approved, implement a capital plan to start replacing the HVAC. What we've learned through our experience this year is to completely replace a system, at least in the summer when we were inquiring, is it's a six-month lead time. So that's why we opted to do repairs this year, but we want to be proactive and not be stuck in August with no air conditioning. So we've put together a capital plan for that. We also have some erosion occurring on the property, and we've included about $35,000 of erosion control and landscaping project.
What type of businesses were leased? Are leasing that?
So on our third floor is hospice care. It's a group of companies that provide hospice care. And on the fourth floor is real estate brokers there. You've heard me speak a couple of times about the capital budget. This is something we've typically had. So you'll see we're budgeting for the HVAC system. One floor each year to spread out the expense. And then we move into the pension admin system and imaging. RFP system requirements, we believe that'll happen in 2025. And we'll expense costs related to that. And then we'll move into the imaging and the system cost hardware testing over the next few years. Of course, these are very preliminary estimates, but based on the work that we've done, we think that they're in the ballpark. And that's it for the budget.
All right.
Questions?
Brenda, would you just do a quick review on the financial audit, and then we'll go back and do the motion on the budget?
Sure. So on the financial audit, you guys saw the actuary report today. That's kind of the last step for us. So we'll forward that on to BDO. They'll be able to complete their work with reviewing the actuary report and the final financial statement. So at the November meeting, you should expect to see the audited financial statement as well as the ACFR, the annual comprehensive financial report. And
okay.
Happy to report that. The other thing I wanted to mention was the system did receive a letter from the Texas Pension Review Board. It's a standard letter, and it's about the fact that they have not received our annual report, although the Pension Board is very cognizant of why they have not received it. Standard letter, 60 days, 210 days, they send these out. They send it not only to the pension system, but to the mayor and to all of the council persons. So just in case you hear anything, we know, we're aware, the Pension Review Board is aware, standard letter. Okay.
All right. Can we have a motion then to direct the staff to revise the proposed budget based upon the direction of the board, bring the revised proposed budget to the board for the November 2024 working consideration for adoption, authorize the forwarding of the 2025 proposed budget to the City of Dallas for comment, and the posting of the proposed budget to the dpfp.org website for member review prior to the November meeting.
I'll make the motion.
Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Kelly, your monthly ministerial and contribution report.
This report is on page, yes, I'll do all three quickly, save some time. So 249 of your presentation is the actions. The only thing I would want to point out to you is the retirements actually are, we only had five this month. I don't ever remember being that low. So year to date, there's 100. Last year, by adding two more months on, there was 144. So that's good news that we're slowing in retirements. I have a story I want to share with you about the benefits team, but I'll save that for next month given the time. So I'll do that next month. The contribution report, there's nothing unusual. The story is a positive story, by the way. just so you don't worry, I saw looks on people's faces. The contribution report, nothing is unusual there. There were 62 more employees at the end of the year, the end of the period than the hiring contract there. On page 252 of your materials is the trustee travel and training. Michael Tagliante has asked to attend the
NSEPR's Public Safety Conference, which is actually a very good conference. I was wanting to go to that, but now have a conflict, so I can't do that. So to allow TAG to go to that, I would need a motion for the board, from the board.
Which one?
He's going to the NSEPR's Public Safety Conference. It's at the end of this month.
So moved.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay. Lone Star, do we go into a session?